Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
In the name of the greatest people that have ever trod this earth, I draw the line in the dust and toss the gauntlet before the feet of tyranny, and I say segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever.
I think George Wallace is the cause of many people's death and certainly much suffering.
The white people of Birmingham should have been commended by the president for their restraint during the present demonstrations. White people have not been involved, only lawless Negroes.
George Wallace was a dynamic expression of the mental derangement of white people. And that, you know, people who are afraid of change and frustration, George Wallace expressed that mental illness. He's dynamic, best in the business.
About 100 people showed up on a cool evening at the Carver. Councilman Alan Warwick was there.
This is going to be a very interesting occasion. I've heard so much about George Wallace. He's always kind of the antagonist for every civil rights story that happened in Alabama during the period.
And I say segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever.
As the movie detailed, George Wallace resisted change in Alabama, just as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. made the state his focus. County registrars were keeping African Americans there from voting. So King asked President Lyndon Johnson to create a new law to ensure black people's voting rights.
We want federal legislation granting Negroes the right to vote.
When Johnson balks, King schedules a march from Selma to Montgomery, a march he knows would make marchers sitting ducks for violence, violence that would also humiliate Johnson into action. The apex of Selma was when the marchers were beaten and tear-gassed at the Edmund Pettus Bridge. Now Congressman John Lewis was nearly beaten to death by police. The footage and news coverage shocked the country and the world.
If the movie is anything close to what really happened, that must have been one of the darkest moments, you know.
Emeka Nwazi originally watched the events play out as a young boy in Nigeria. Monday night at the Carver Center was pretty intense.
I was close to tears at some point. I loved the movie. I mean, I loved the production, and to me, it brought a whole lot of things close to home.
But the Selma screening was only half of what went on. Alabama Governor George Wallace had a daughter, and Monday night she came to speak to a majority black audience.
But the lines we must stand in to build a new America are those that lead to the ballot box.
Peggy Wallace Kennedy's message is a decidedly different one than her father's.
I speak on racial healing and racial harmony.
And she has a curious companion in that ongoing struggle, Congressman John Lewis.
We have become fast friends and have been friends since 2009, and it was a wonderful experience.
The experience she's talking about is that of walking the Edmund Pettus Bridge at his side. Did anything stand out in her memory?
Yes, he asked me if they were going too fast for me and if they needed to slow down for me, which I thought was very ironic that he wanted to know all about my comfort when he was the one who was viciously beaten at the foot of the bridge. And I kept saying, no, sir, everything's fine with me.
Walking that notorious bridge wasn't the end of her time with Lewis. They've become good friends.
He's taught me a great deal about reconciliation and love and how that can heal the human heart.
The daughter of the man ultimately responsible for the beating of John Lewis has learned much about peace and redemption from the man who actually took the beating.
He is always in my heart when I go and speak all over the country.
Redemption found its way to the Alabama governor, too, late in life, when he renounced segregation and asked for forgiveness. Jack Morgan, Texas Public Radio News.
Now I really understand what they mean when they say white power. White power, yeah. White power, yeah. Come on. White power, it's white power. White power.
When I was introduced to this skinhead gang, because it was made up mostly of young white males, was driven by testosterone. So music played a large influence. And in fact, there were very few American bands who were playing white power music, and there was nobody selling it. So I decided to borrow $3,000 from family, and I opened a small record shop in Alsip, Illinois, called Chaos Records, with the intent of selling this white power music. And in fact, because this was pre-internet, people would come in from all over the country to buy this music, and it ended up becoming 75% of my gross revenue. But because I wanted to also be a good business person, I stocked the shelves of my small store with heavy metal and punk rock and ska and hip-hop. People started to come in to buy that music, and over time I started to build a relationship with these people, and I started to dialogue for the first time with black people. And I started to become friends with these people unwittingly at first, you know, because at first it was very standoffish. I bit my tongue. I didn't really like these people. And I decided their money was just as good as anybody else's. And when I decided to pull the white power music from the shelf, the store closed because we went bankrupt. It was 75% of my sales. And I'd pulled it because I was so embarrassed to sell it in front of these people who I'd now considered friends.
You've probably worked with people who are very racist. Have you successfully changed people's minds or gotten people to think differently?
White people have a hard time talking about race. It was a 31-year-old white male who was former military and was discharged because of an injury, married with a small child, who had a deep-seated hatred for Muslims. And one of the first things that I did was ask him if he would be willing to go visit a mosque with me. And this was, and I brought this up right after he had mentioned to me that he had seen a Muslim person praying the day before, and it took everything in him to not go up to him and kick him in the throat. So we went to the mosque, and I introduced him to the imam, and we sat around a table. Very openly, we asked questions. Subject asked questions to the imam, and the imam asked questions back. And before we knew it, we had spent over 2 hours sitting in this room and then moved into the prayer room where they showed us how to pray. And I'm happy to say now that he has brought his wife and his daughter there. Is not ready to convert or anything like that, but has a new appreciation and a new understanding of what this foreign culture to him really is, because I really believe that hate springs from ignorance. Ignorance turns into fear. Fear turns into hatred, and hatred often manifests as violence. And unless we work really hard to understand each other, we can't get to a place where we have racial justice, because there's always going to be one group that feels like they're more superior than the rest.
Okay, Donald Trump. I say meet your next president. See, all kind of people from the time he started talking. Oh, he's crazy. Oh, he's this. Oh, he won't. Oh, the American people won't accept some. Donald Trump has pulled the hood off of, the sheet off of, the cover off of the system of racism, white supremacy. See, he pulled it off, and he's talking with more clarity than anybody else, who all the other candidates quietly are thinking about racism, but they're not talking overtly about it. But Donald Trump is talking. So like I said, Donald Trump's Trump card is the race card in the system of racism, white supremacy.
The United States Census Bureau predicts that by 2042, white people in this country will become a minority. This is already the case in some states, including California. In the last major census, the government reported that the U.S. population as a whole increased 10% between years 2000 and 2010, and Latino and Asian populations grew the most at 43%. Native Americans grew by 18%, African Americans by 12%, and white people, well, just 1%. There are already more babies from other minority groups combined than white babies. It can be argued that these changing demographics are playing out in the political realm. In the last two presidential elections, non-whites went to the polls in historic numbers and not only elected Barack Obama twice as president, but also gave congressional Democrats big victories. In the congressional midterm elections, non-whites did not turn out as in the presidential elections, and Congress moved towards the right. It can be argued that white people's fear of the changing demographics is fueling large support for such candidates as Donald Trump and Ted Cruz in the Republican primaries. Today we're going to be in conversation about these changing demographics and what it means towards this idea of whiteness. My guest is Linda Martine Alcoff. Linda Martine Alcoff is a professor of philosophy at Hunter College and CUNY Graduate Center. Her writings have focused on social identity and race, as well as other things. From 2012 to 2013, she served as the president of the American Philosophical Association Eastern Division, and she is the author of the new book, The Future of Whiteness. She joins us over Skype. Linda Martine Alcoff, it's my very good pleasure to welcome you to this radio program.
Thank you so much.
When observing the campaigns in a presidential election year, do you see these demographic numbers that we just laid out playing out in these campaigns?
Yes, very centrally. And it's unfortunate that they're not talked about more than they are talked about, I guess, in intelligent ways. That's why I really wrote the book. I think whiteness has to do with so much going on in this country, from electoral politics to the debates over gun reform, immigration, tax policy. So it's you know, and for the Republicans, because their base is still predominantly white, they are very concerned to develop a set of policies and a way of speaking, a rhetoric, that will address their white voters, calm their fears, you know, address their economic concerns as well as their cultural concerns about the changing conditions of the United States.
Not something we just see in the United States. You're right, we see this in Europe as well.
Yes, by the start of the next century, demographers predict that Europe will be a majority Muslim country. And that prediction was made before the recent refugee crisis that changed the numbers. So I think both Europe and the United States are undergoing these demographic changes, and they're real. And I think they are causing understandable ferment and people not being sure what the future will bring. But unfortunately, most of the analyses given by Republicans or the right, like Donald Trump, who came up with, you know, a lot of his language from Ann Coulter, if you read Ann Coulter's book, recent book on the United States becoming a third world hellhole because of all the Latinos coming into the U.S. You know, that sort of analysis is not based on facts, it's not based on reality, and it's certainly politically divisive and, you know, problematic in a variety of ways.
This past weekend at a Donald Trump rally in North Carolina, we saw Rose Hamid, 56-year-old flight attendant who's Muslim, stand up during his event. Didn't say anything. It was somewhat of a silent protest. She had a shirt that said, "I come in peace." She was kicked out of that event. You saw many people yelling at her as she was led out of the arena. Can you tell me more, Linda Martin Alcoff, about what you're seeing and about the support that Donald Trump, and I say support, a new poll put out over the weekend suggests that, or at least of the people polled, 20% of Democrats would actually vote for Donald Trump. Can you talk to me about the support we see for Donald Trump in his rhetoric?
Yes, it's a disturbing phenomena for many of us because he's giving license to not only certain political ideas, but also to political behavior and organizational behavior that's terrorizing certain minoritized groups in the United States. I mean, not only does he kick people out of his press conferences. He famously kicked out Jorge Ramos, the sort of the Walter Cronkite of Univision. But, you know, other protesters at his events. But then the people at the events inflict, a barrage of racist, anti-Muslim comments and threats on these folks. So it's very worrisome. What I would also say, though, is I think it's complicated. The support that Trump is getting is based on some bogus fears, I would say, about the changing conditions in the United States, but it's also based on some legitimate and real fears that people have, white workers in particular have, about their threatened economic livelihoods. And so what he's doing is, of course, diverting their legitimate concerns about loss of jobs and decline in wages and decline in the prospects for their kids' livelihoods. He's diverting that into an anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim, etc. hysteria. But those concerns are real, and some of Trump's rhetoric, you know, sometimes addresses those in interesting ways. He's a complicated figure. I think the issue is that there is a sizable chunk of Trump supporters who could be addressed in a meaningful way by other candidates. And Sanders tried to do that this last weekend. I think he gave a talk in Iowa that was really pitched to white workers to talk about their economic interests and how their economic interests are actually allied with the economic interests of people of color in the United States rather than opposed to them.
Is what we're seeing with Trump, is this a precedent, do you think, for what we'll see to come? Or is this sort of the last throes of a particular ideology?
I think it will continue and it will get worse. That's my prediction, because these demographic changes, as you said in your opening, are real. By 2042, the already, you know, four states in the United States are majority, minority, and most major cities are. So people's lives are changing. And so I think that as this continues to change, there will be more reaction and more misunderstanding and more fears and more organizing by the white nativists or racist groups. But hopefully we will also begin to have some pushback in the public discussions that provides an alternative analysis than saying that we're just going down the tubes as a nation because of all these black and brown and Muslim folks coming in.
Let's talk more about what you'll call the real fears, the true fears that white workers have with changing demographic. What do people fear of losing? Is it status? Is it privilege? Is it all these things?
Well, since the founding of the United States, really one of the first rulings that the Constitutional Congress passed, there's been political and economic set-asides and advantages given to white citizens, white male citizens in the beginning, over others. And that, you know, has been very significant in helping masses of white people get a leg up and not get rich, but to, you know, be able to own a home and have a job and had decent working conditions.
The middle class that we're always hearing about.
Yeah, from in most recent history, from the GI Bill forward, people were able to get jobs that made it possible for them to own homes. Most of all of our wealth is in our homes, if we're lucky enough to own one. People can then use their home value to deal with financial crises that come up, to put their kids through college. I mean, it's really important. And the value of your home actually has to do with how many white people live in your neighborhood, right? So it's an arbitrary issue. It has nothing to do with how strongly built the home is, how well you've kept it up. It really has all to do with the racial makeup of the particular neighborhood. And here, whites, of course, were advantaged. So these are real economic advantages. And there's also kind of certain political advantages in terms of the right to vote for a long time that whites have enjoyed. I think we're in a period of a new social contract. I mean, after 2008 economic collapse, you can really see it where white worker type jobs are no longer unionized. Their wages, the way real wages have dropped dramatically. The conditions of white workers is way more precarious than it used to be. That's a reality.
The presidential election is now 9 months away, which explains why we're all experiencing morning sickness, I think. But we've already had the most important vote of 2016, in my opinion, because on Monday, a small town in upstate New York asked its citizens to decide whether or not they should keep their official seal. Now, it seems that someone from outside of the town had called the town seal racist. But that term gets thrown around so casually these days. So let's take a look for ourselves. What do we got here? Okay, that looks like a guy. That's a white guy strangling an Indian.
I'm in Whitesboro, New York, where its residents recently passed a vote to keep a controversial seal in order that's been a symbol of the village since 1883. The seal appears to show a white man strangling an Indian. I'm going to talk with some people in the area and see what they have to say about it. When you first saw the seal, what was your first impression?
They're hitting each other. And I couldn't understand why the village would approve that one.
The town actually comes from a guy named Hugh White, who, you know, founded the Whitesboro. He's actually on the seal, and he's the one that had the wrestling match with the Indian. And that was their peace. That was their way of saying, hey, you know, we're finally not a team, but we're civil with each other.
I think even if a Native American saw it, I don't know that they would be offended by it, especially if they were given the history behind it.
Do you think the seal comes across as racist?
In a matter of speaking, because it looks like the white guy is hitting the Indian.
Did you vote?
Yes, I did, and I voted to keep it. Honestly, I think that it's part of our history. I find nothing offensive about it.
I didn't vote because I thought it was a bunch of nonsense, and I'm lazy.
How do you feel about the controversy surrounding the seal?
I think it is absolutely ridiculous. The seal's been here for a long time, and I think it should stay.
I know the village seal does kind of look like a white man strangling an Indian, but the truth is it's a sign of peace. Our village seal shows our reconcile with them and our peacefulness with them.
How would you describe the seal?
Just two men having fun. That's what it looks like to me.
This the city of Chicago. Chicago.
Last year, Mays Jackson actively supported Rahm Emanuel during the mayoral runoff. He posed for pictures. He said Emanuel was a good choice for the younger generation.
It's come back to bite me in some ways.
Jackson is with the Intelligence Group, a digital strategy firm, and he does commentary for WVON.
Every time I make a statement in regards to the mayor, somebody finds my endorsement picture and posts it on Facebook or sends it around. It's an opportunity for people to kind of say, I told you so, even though a majority of the black community did vote for him.
Emanuel did win the majority of black wards twice. While not completely distancing himself from the mayor, Jackson's been critical of Emanuel's response to the fallout from the Laquan McDonald shooting. But he thinks this could also be a chance to get the mayor to listen to black demands.
I don't believe that the mayor is going to resign, but the black community has to be smart enough to say, what is it that we can leverage? What are the opportunities that we can get out of here when we had a tone-deaf mayor who probably didn't recognize the Tale of Two Cities, but now is willing to do anything to bring those two cities together?
Ever since the week of Thanksgiving, when the city released the video of a white police officer killing the black teenage McDonald, Emanuel has been accused of instigating a cover-up. He's also been criticized for not doing enough to acknowledge police shootings in black and brown communities. At the same time, his administration faces national and international scrutiny as it tries to capture public trust. Hermine Hartman is publisher of Indigo. Now, you supported Rahm in 2011, right?
Twice.
Do you regret that?
Well, no, you don't regret it, because truth be told, when you support a politician, you are supporting the promise of the politician.
That promise perhaps could be realized, even more so now that Hartman says Emanuel is at a crossroads. Her message to the mayor is to get out of his comfort zone and move beyond courting black pastors.
This is a tale of two cities. Chicago has got to come together. We have got to be one city. We cannot be patronized. We cannot be disrespected. We have got to be included. And inclusion is not the red line. And I'm going to give you some temporary jobs to drive the bus, to do the heavy lifting, da, da, da. I want to see some economic plans for the west side, the south side of Chicago, that compare to Lincoln Park.
In a racially divided city, the very voting bloc that supported him is now the most vociferous against him. During the tight reelection campaign last year, the mayor donned sweaters and promised to be a softer leader and a better listener. Some say for the black community, that moment has now arrived and can't be squandered. Northeastern Illinois University professor Conrad Worrell agrees economic development is the biggest win African Americans can gain from the mayor during this political turmoil. But Worrell says there's a lack of black political unity.
Right now, we don't have a common approach, a common direction, and a common agenda to maximize our strength as a voting bloc, black people in the city of Chicago. It's too much ambulance chasing going on. We respond to this, we respond to that, without substance, without a strategy underneath.
Worrell says after the 1987 death of the city's first black mayor, Harold Washington, black political fractures emerged and stayed. But that could finally change by bringing young people and elders together. Emanuel's vulnerability could mean black victory.
The opportunity is staring us in the face. Whether we take advantage of the opportunity is another question.
And even though Worrell voted for Emanuel, he says in politics, there are no permanent friends or enemies. Natalie Moore, WBEZ.
Once again, police beating up on people.
Back up and get on that step, okay? Back up.
All he did was break up a fight. And this is what happens for breaking up a fight.
This is a disgrace. This is a test in this city. And we intend to keep the pressure on.
Let's continue to show this nation who we are. Continue to show this country who we are.
In the 18 months since Eric Garner's death at the hands of New York City police, his family has led a tireless campaign for charges against the officers involved. Now one officer is facing charges. They're departmental charges. But she's not one of the officers who directly was involved in the chokehold death of Eric Garner. Instead, Sergeant Kizzy Adonis, who is African-American, faces internal departmental charges of, quote, failing to supervise. Adonis was one of two supervising officers who responded to the scene and watched it unfold. She's been stripped of her badge and gun. The internal charges against Adonis come just over a year after a grand jury decided not to indict the white police officer, Daniel Pantaleo, for taking Garner's life. After Officer Pantaleo pulled Garner to the ground in the chokehold, officers then piled on top, as Garner said, "I can't breathe," 11 times. The officers had confronted Garner for allegedly selling loose cigarettes. His family reached a $5.9 million settlement with New York City in July. Officer Pantaleo remains under Justice Department investigation. While some have welcomed the charges against Sergeant Adonis as a step forward in the case, Eric Garner's daughter, Erica, has spoken out in Adonis's defense. Eric Garner says Sergeant Adonis was the only officer at the scene who tried to save her father's life. And while Adonis is the first officer to face reprimand, the only person who's actually been criminally charged who was at the scene that day is not an officer. Ramsey Orta, the young man who actually filmed the fatal chokehold on his cell phone and released the footage, has been arrested multiple times by police since Garner's death. Ramsey Orta says police have deliberately targeted him for capturing Garner's death on video and exposing it to the world. Supporters, including Erica Garner, joined Ramsey Orta on Monday at yet another of his court appearances on Staten Island. Erica Garner refers to Ramsey Orta as the only man charged in my dad's death. Well, to discuss these latest developments, Erica Garner and Ramsey Orta join us now. And we're joined in San Francisco by Reggie Harris, a member of the Black Organizing Project, an advisor to Erica Garner. Let's begin with you, Erica. So talk about this latest news. I mean, a grand jury did not indict any officers, but the New York Police Department has brought the sergeant, the supervising officer, Adonis, up on departmental charges. Your thoughts?
My initial thought was, it was no surprise. In the beginning, when the reports was being leaked to the media, we already knew that they was highlighting Kizzy Adonis' actions, the fact that she lied on the report. Now, a year and a half later—
What was that lie?
Oh, that my dad wasn't in distress. She heard him say that I can't breathe, but he wasn't in—she believed that he wasn't in distress, which was clearly a lie. So a year and a half later, for them to charge her for a failure to supervise, I think is ridiculous. I think it's a political move. Those officers, as you can clearly see on the video, if she did say, let up, you got them already— She's a supervising officer, and they disobeyed a direct order. And that furthers supports my argument in my article or my YouTube video when I say that if you can find charges or enough charges to charge this black lady on failure to supervise, it was a lot of cops on the scene that day. And how come the other sergeant wasn't charged yet? How come the borough commander? How come Bill de Blasio, the city's mayor? How come Mayor de Blasio and William Breton, the commissioner? It's a lot of people that should be charged with failure to supervise because they failed us on that day.
What has happened to Officer Pantaleo, the man who put your dad in a chokehold?
He still has his job. He's still getting paid. He's still walking the streets of Staten Island. He's still being this monster to the black community in Staten Island. Even though he's put on modified duty, he's still running amok in Staten Island. So nothing.
We did call the New York Police Department. They said they wouldn't come on, but said probationary Sergeant Kizzy Adonis of the 120th Precinct was served with disciplinary charges today in connection with the NYPD internal review of the July 17, 2014 incident on Staten Island involving Eric Garner. Sergeant Adonis has also been placed on modified assignment status.
I'm aware of that. It's been playing for about a week and a half, and that's not enough. You know, I don't think she should be charged. Like, if she's charged, that means you're admitting that a murder went down in my dad's case. You're expressing, New York is expressing, the New York Police Department is not taking full liability, but they are saying that something wrong went down.
Interestingly, they said at the request of the U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of New York, the internal disciplinary review of the Garner incident has been placed on hold pending a federal inquiry. The NYPD, in consultation with the U.S. Attorney's Office, served the departmental charges at this time in order to preserve the disciplinary statute of limitations. And it goes on from there. What is this federal inquiry, and what do you understand is happening?
I just think all these investigations that's going on is like a game of ping pong. They keep on bouncing back and forth. Well, I'm waiting for this. I'm waiting for that. I sat on a panel like last month with the Civil Rights Liberty, and it was representatives from the Department of Justice. And I clearly looked the man in the eye, and I asked him, I was like, if I was your family member, would you tell me the same thing, that I need to wait to see if any charges or anything? If, like, basically, if you're in my position, how would you feel if I was your daughter? And I told them, basically, you know, time is up. We demand answers so we can have closure. This has been dragging on for a year and a half, and there's no sense for it to be a year and a half if you can come up 18 months later and say, oh, well, this black officer, Kizzy Adonis, is guilty of failure to supervise. That's the only answer that we got after a year and a half.
I want to go back to that day in August of 2014 to the police. It was July of 2014. Ramsey Orta, we have seen your video countless times. The world has seen this video, but we have rarely heard your voice. Talk about what you saw happen that day and what inspired you to flip open your cell phone and start filming.
What I saw that day was NYPD murder my friend. And what inspired me to take the video, because I have past videos of NYPD abusing their power with people I associate with.
And so you started filming?
Yes.
You didn't stop?
No.
Your hand is remarkably steady as we show this video.
Yes.
What were you thinking?
I was about to go down. And I just had to make sure I stood there and make sure I had got every detail and I ain't missed nothing.
And what were you feeling as you were filming? You were a friend of Eric Garner's.
I was upset. I mean, you could clearly hear it in the video. I was running my mouth in the video, but I was highly upset.
What were you saying?
I was cursing. I'm calling them names. I'm telling them to leave him alone. And that I have witnessed that he wasn't selling any loose cigarettes, that he just had broke up a fight.
Well, explain that. He was known for selling Lucy's loose cigarettes, but actually on this day, there had been a fight in the street, and he had gone to mediate the fight, to try to break it up?
The fight had broken out maybe 2 feet away from us. He jumped up and separated them. As soon as he separated them, the cops came out the car and targeted Eric.
What has happened to you since July 17, 2014? First, what did you do with that video?
The Daily News got in contact with me and asked me if I had any pictures, and I told them I got a video, and we took it from there. And from then on, I've been targeted by NYPD. I got 5 pending cases right now, 2 in Supreme Court, 3 in criminal. Since then, I've just been harassed. I've been almost killed in Rikers Island.
How long were you held at Rikers Island? We interviewed your aunt at the time that you were in Rikers.
I was in Rikers 2 separate times, one for 60 days and one for 30 days, I believe. And the 60-day stay was the time that I went on the hunger strike.
For how long?
A month and a half.
What were you striking about?
The rat poison, and I didn't want to eat nothing that Rikers provided me.
Why? What do you mean, rat poison?
It was rat poison in the food.
Did you think you were being targeted?
Yes.
Now, you were arrested. Your wife was also arrested?
Yes.
Why was she arrested?
She got arrested for assault charges that was allegedly caught on camera. And Now we come here today and the charges brought up against her dropped.
You've been arrested on for drug offenses. In one of those arrests, you said that the police officer said to you, you videoed us. Now we're videoing you. Mm-hmm. Can you explain when that was and what they said?
Clearly, when they jumped out on me, that was the first thing that came out of his mouth. Like, you filmed us, so now we're filming you. Because I asked, why do you have your cameras out? Like, when they jumped out on me, they had their phones in their hand instead of a gun or anything, from my knowledge, was supposed to be in their hand. So I asked him, why is he filming me? And he said, because you filmed us.
Are you sorry you filmed the death of your friend, Eric Garner? Are you sorry you put it out for the world to see?
No, I am sorry for not having a legal defense before I actually put the video out there. Other than that, I don't regret nothing.
What do you mean, a legal defense?
As far as lawyers and people that I know that can protect me for any retaliation from happening.
Have you sued the New York Police Department?
No.
Do you plan to?
Yes.
Why?
It took my life away from me. It took my friend's life away from me. I mean, there's nothing more I could say.
What do you say to Ramsey Orta? Erica, soon after your dad died, there was a big service in Staten Island at a church. And when Ramsey Orta's name was mentioned, the entire, all of the people there, and this church was packed to the rafters, applauded. What has Ramsey Orta meant to you and your family?
Like a hero. I just want to say that, you know, hearing him, being in the same room with him, hearing the words come out of his mouth instead of just reading it in a newspaper, it really hits home. There was a lot of craziness in the beginning, but my family always respected the fact that he recorded this video. But, you know, in a way, I feel like I could have been there for him a little bit more, but I just don't know how. Like, we was put in this position. Both our lives was destroyed. The police, with the constant, I get harassed on Twitter. You know, he get harassed in person. And, you know, I'm just here for him. You know, whatever he needs. I want to use, you know, whatever I'm doing, the work that I'm doing now, to really capture his voice. He hasn't been really recognized in the media, and I just want to, you know, be able to project that to the world, you know, about the way things happened, knowing firsthand, you know, what's going on with his cases and keeping people updated on what he's being charged with and his cases and stuff. I just want to offer support. You know, my family... we talk about him a lot, you know, and we say how it's disgusting how they keep on targeting him. Like when he was in jail and being rat poisoned with the rat poison in his food, like I was hurt. Like he's already like there and not supposed to be there, and now y'all trying to kill him and.
What proof did you have that there was rat poison in your food, Ramsey?
I was serving the food, for one. And two, a couple of my friends had saved some of the food. And when the time came, we gave it to the Department of Health, and they brought back the lab saying that it was rat poison.
Black babies cost less.
Do the private-turned-public lives of two boys answer the age-old debate about the power of fate versus free will? I've been thinking a lot about that while comparing the stories of 12-year-old Tamir Rice, who lost his life at the hands of Cleveland police officers, and 16-year-old Ethan Couch, who took the lives of four people while driving drunk. There are few who would disagree that birth and circumstances shape the trajectory of Tamir Rice. Fate decreed he be born poor and black. A recent New York Times editorial described his life as hemmed in by forces that deny your humanity and conspire to kill you. Fate conspired to place the 12-year-old in his neighborhood park playing with his toy gun, and fate put him in the crosshairs of two Cleveland police officers. His terrible preordained destiny played out in a flash after the cops gunned him down within a documented 2 seconds of arriving on the scene. And how much more awful that Tamir's main shooter was fired from his first job because he didn't have the professional temperament to handle firearms. Officer Timothy Lohman's boss saying that neither time nor training would be able to correct his deficiencies. English playwright James Shirley said there is no armor against fate. Tamir had no protection and no relief even after death. Cleveland's district attorney spent 1 year investigating his killing, only to announce that there wasn't enough evidence to indict Officer Lohman and his partner. Telling that few are surprised. If Tamir's grim destiny seemed preordained by a cruel fate, young Ethan Couch was gifted with a gilded life supported and encouraged by rich parents. Ethan's birth and circumstances gave him a keen advantage. He was able to use his free will to shape his own destiny. Too bad Ethan didn't care enough. He ingested 3 times the legal amount of alcohol and drove friends on a beer-fueled joyride. Speeding down a dark road, he ran over 4 pedestrians, killing them all. One of his passengers was left paralyzed. In court, his defense claimed Ethan suffered from affluenza, the inability to understand consequences due to privilege and extreme spoiling. In other words, horribly bad judgment. Unlike Tamir, he created his own tragedy. He didn't have to drink until drunk, or to get behind the wheel, or to speed on that road. Bad choices and abuse of free will. The same free will that he used to break probation by attending prohibited beer parties and to escape to Mexico with his mother. Free will carried many a soul to hell, stated preacher Charles Spurgeon, but never a soul to heaven. The waste of Tamir's too young life and the excess of the overindulged Ethan offends me. I don't know if their 2 stories definitively answer any questions about destiny. But if there is indeed a natural order to the universe, justice can't come soon enough. I'm Callie Crossley, WGBH, Boston's local NPR.
Why is it that there's a gun shop on almost every corner in this community?
Why?
Tell you why. For the same reason that there's a liquor store on almost every corner in the black community. Why? They want us to kill ourselves.
A new analysis of marijuana dispensaries in Denver turned up some pretty unfortunate information. In fact, the Denver Post looked into zoning laws in Denver and where marijuana dispensaries are likely to exist. And it turns out that they're disproportionately represented in poor and minority parts of Denver. Let me give you the details. A January 3rd analysis by the Denver Post found that companies with pot licenses in the city, where cannabis use has been legal since 2014 for recreational use, are mostly in low-income neighborhoods with high proportions of ethnic minorities. Just 3 of those neighborhoods account for about a quarter of local marijuana-related facilities. Marijuana businesses are not allowed to set up in residential or mixed-use neighborhoods near schools or childcare centers. Okay, so let's stop right there. What happened when Colorado finally legalized marijuana for recreational use, it did so with a lot of different caveats. And one of the caveats, or one of the rules, was that they would have very strict zoning laws to ensure that these dispensaries are nowhere near kids, right? To kind of calm down all of the worries that, hey, you know, if we legalize it and these dispensaries exist, then all these kids are going to be smoking pot. Drug use is going to go up. There was no evidence that that was going to happen.
Yeah. There's evidence of the opposite.
But yeah, there's fear-mongering. And so people wanted to vote in favor of legalizing it, but they wanted, you know, certain rules and regulations in place, which I totally understand. But there are ramifications to those rules and regulations. And to have all the pot or the majority of the pot dispensaries located in poor neighborhoods is not necessarily the best thing in the world.
Yeah, so my initial reaction to this was inaccurate, and thankfully you and JR provided information. So I thought, well, this is something that we think people should have access to, that should be legal. So isn't it better to have more in your neighborhood so that you have access to it? Like, if we think it's not dangerous and it's not just simply it being around isn't going to drastically affect people's rate of using it, then they should have access to it. But I think JR pointed out that it's likely that real estate prices in that area might go down, which is probably true. I hope that over time, as it becomes legal in more and more areas, people understand that there is absolutely no reason why the real estate prices should go down because there's nothing wrong with smoking marijuana.
So there have been fears in the past that there would be crime surrounding these marijuana dispensaries, but there have been studies that have debunked that because the reality is there's so much security involved with marijuana dispensaries that crime actually tends to go down in those areas.
Why would there be a lot of crime?
Dude,
because people smoke and then they just go crazy? No, that's not what marijuana does. And by the way, the idea that like, oh, now you can smoke marijuana in Colorado. No, now you can legally smoke marijuana in Colorado. Before it was illegal, you could smoke all the illegal marijuana you wanted.
Right.
And the idea that like kids, oh, we can't have it around the kids because then kids will discover what marijuana is. They knew what it was.
Yeah.
They knew what it was. And largely, if they wanted to get it, they could probably get it.
Yes, that's exactly right. I do want to clarify one thing, though. I am not in the camp that believes that marijuana is completely harmless. And I know that you're not in that camp either.
I'm not saying completely harmless.
No, no,
I'm saying way less harmful than alcohol.
Than alcohol.
And probably tobacco as well.
I totally agree with you on that. I don't want kids smoking marijuana. I think that...
I don't want infants smoking marijuana.
I
unless they can roll.
Adults who know what they're doing to smoke marijuana. Because, look... I know people are going to argue that this is not what really happens, and no, it's bull. No, I smoke weed a lot. Okay,
a lot.
Every night when I go
home,
I'm smoking
right
now. I want to unwind. And here's what it does: it makes me lazy and it makes me relax. I don't want kids to be lazy and relaxed. Okay.
Yeah.
I want adults who have had a long, hard day of work to be able to go home and smoke weed to relax.
I agree.
And fall asleep peacefully and happily. Right.
Yes. While watching How to Make a Murderer.
Right. But it does like lower your motivation quite a bit. And that's why I think it's a terrible idea for kids who still have brains that are growing and developing to be smoking marijuana.
Yeah.
But again, there are laws in place to prevent kids from doing it. So
yeah, they can't do it.
Exactly.
Legally, in the same way. And look, I don't think that you should smoke when you're young too. I mean, look, generally, when I say that it doesn't do any harm, I'm not saying that it doesn't make you lazier or whatever. I think it does, which is one of the reasons I don't, even though I have in the past and could if I wanted to. But I think that it should become one of the things that you as a parent and whoever has influence over kids teaches them. Look, this is a thing that you can do. And by the way, as we're having this conversation, I'm doing it. But you shouldn't do it all you want. And if a kid wants to be lazy, there are all sorts of things. Like if he could start drinking earlier, he could not exercise, he could eat a horrible diet. Like there's all sorts of things that you need to teach your kids. If you do this to excess, it's going to have a negative effect on your body. Marijuana is one of them, but thankfully it's not nearly as dangerous as something like alcohol, which is still one of the most socially acceptable consumable things in America.
Yes, and also another note to keep in mind is that the majority of liquor stores are also, you know, kind of clustered in these poor areas.
Yeah.
So one final thing I want to make sure you guys know about. Under Denver's rules, 46% of the land in low-income areas was eligible for these dispensaries, while the wealthier areas, when it came to the wealthier areas, that number fell down to 29%. In neighborhoods with mostly non-white populations, 35% of land was available for dispensaries compared to 29% elsewhere.
I don't understand why that matters. Am I crazy? Because, like, so if 35% is available to have a dispensary put into it in one area and 29% in the other, it's not like you need 50% of a neighborhood to put a gigantic dispensary down.
Yeah.
You probably need 1% of a neighborhood to put a dispensary in.
Right.
So what's the difference if it's 29 or 35? You should be able to put one anywhere.
Yeah. No, I agree with you on that. The Denver Post is just trying to make a point about how there's less availability in the wealthier, whiter parts of
Denver. And it's a demonstration that the whiter areas are more purely residential, whereas the minority areas tend to be more mixed use.
Exactly.
It certainly demonstrates that.
So, for the second straight year, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences somehow managed to release nominations for 20 different actors, and none went to people of color. Yep. Maybe this was just one of those years when all the great actors in America just happened to be white, just like so many years before. Oh, wait. Chris Rock is hosting this year's event, and I can't decide if I think he should bow out in solidarity with his Hollywood colleagues or simply take everyone in the room to task for their obvious, even if apparently unintentional, bias when it comes to judging performances. Of course, No one should need an award for validation, but so many careers hinge on these things, so it matters. Alas, no Idris Elba for Beast of No Nation, no Benicio del Toro for Sicario, and no Michael B. Jordan for Creed, to name a few, will be gracing the stage to make speeches at the end of February. But that doesn't mean their performances weren't worthy of your time or your money. Check them out. I'm Clinton Yates, and that's my take.
Netflix. It made a big announcement recently. The online streaming service is expanding into an additional 130 countries, including in sub-Saharan Africa. Russell Southwood is the chief executive of Balancing Act. That's a consultancy specializing in telecoms and the internet in Africa. I got to say, given the politics in Nigeria, I'm really hoping there is a House of Cards Abuja that becomes a thing, because the Kevin Spacey version would pale, I think, in comparison. Is that where things are headed for Netflix?
Netflix, in fact, is covering the whole of the African continent, including North Africa. It's very, very early days for them. They kind of pre-signaled that they were going to come into South Africa, which is one of the bigger markets. At the moment, they're buying modestly in terms of content, it seems, as far as we can make out.
So just practically speaking, what does Netflix going into the African market mean for Africans? What will they get?
They will get pretty much the same international range of programming, both TV programs and films, that everyone else gets. In addition, they will have a gathering of films that will be both African in orientation and maybe even specific to their country. So if you're living in Nigeria or South Africa, you may well see movies from your own country. My guess would be that they have chosen a sort of select amount of African content to go with to start with, and they'll build that up slowly.
I mean, you've got countries like Nigeria and Kenya. They produce a lot of content. There are active kind of filmmaking industries going on there. Will this help those filmmakers and that whole infrastructure?
A company of the scale of Netflix coming in will hopefully drive a process of professionalization. At the moment, there is an increasing demand for African content, not least because Africa is making the transition to digital broadcasting and the number of channels is increasing.
So $7.99 a month for Netflix. A lot of people in Africa live on $3 a day. That seems like a lot of money to shell out for streaming. Why is Netflix going into the African market?
It, like many others, can see the future is in places like Africa. I think that $7.99 is a lot of money to somebody living on $4 a day, but actually that's not the whole story of Africa. Africa also has, in a number of countries, a reasonably large middle class, and therefore those people will have little or no difficulty paying. You're already talking about several million people already pay for pay TV services on the continent, so there's a willingness to pay there. And amongst the middle class, that sort of money is not always easy to find, but is one of the things that people tend to find money for.
Even among the wealthy, there seems to be an obvious catch, and that is this is a snazzy new technology introduced to some places where there's severely outdated infrastructure. Rolling blackouts are a daily event, if not an hourly event. It's not a winning combination, is it?
There is a very real problem with both network speeds and the cost of bandwidth and reliability in general. But the arrival of somebody like Netflix, in a sense, asks all those who are involved in providing bandwidth of this kind to up their game. I spoke recently to a colleague in Zambia who was telling me that he had bought a fiber to the home connection from a company in Africa called Liquid Telecom. He has given up his pay TV subscription and now streams all the content he wants to see on this fiber connection. So it's not impossible to do, and that's the future we're all hoping for.
So with Netflix going into Africa, going to Latin America, will I be able to see like Nollywood dramas now from Nigeria or Latin American telenovelas? I mean, that would be very interesting for a lot of the diaspora living in this country.
I think you'll find that there will be a range of different African programming, and the diaspora will be the first people to watch it, and then some small part of that content will be watched by other people.
Russell Southwood, chief executive of Balancing Act. That's a consultancy specializing in telecoms and the internet in Africa. Thank you.
Thanks for talking to me.
It's so comforting that the party of impotent white rage There's also the party of concealed carry and stand your ground. I tell you, these guys love the Second Amendment like nobody's business.
Black people are disproportionately victimized by gun violence, and prominent African-American leaders are among those calling for tighter gun control. Yet, as Karen Grigsby Bates of NPR's Code Switch team found out, many other African-Americans believe that owning guns is crucial to protecting themselves and their rights.
Know how some people can't do without something? April Howard has three possessions that are non-negotiable.
I have a .22, a .38, and a rifle.
And she's keeping them all. Howard's had guns for several years now, the result of a close call at her D.C. metro area home that still makes her shudder.
Someone was breaking into my home while I was home alone at 7 a.m. in the morning. That prompted me to immediately get some form of protection for me and my home.
That doesn't make Howard unusual, says Charles Cobb. Cobb's book, This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed, How Guns Made the Civil Rights Movement, looks at Black Americans' historic relationship to guns. For decades, Cobb says, most Blacks lived in the rural South and had guns.
And this is a tradition that goes all the way back to the end of the Civil War and the Reconstruction era. Black people have traditionally used guns for self-defense.
Cobb says guns were kept on farms for hunting, for pest control, and to repel white vigilantes. Even nonviolent participants in the civil rights movement, including Martin Luther King for a time, kept guns at home to protect their families. In the mid-60s, Malcolm X responded to a rumor that the Nation of Islam was urging blacks to buy guns by reminding the press they were legally entitled to do that.
America is based upon the right of people to organize for self-defense. This is in the Constitution of the United States.
In California, the Black Panther Party carried loaded rifles to the state capitol in Sacramento to remind residents in black neighborhoods like Oakland they could.
Revolution has come. Okay. Time to pick up the gun. Okay.
After that, the state shock lawmakers made carrying loaded firearms illegal. And in 1968, after several urban riots, the Federal Gun Control Act was passed, which attempted to ban the sale of cheap handguns. What that did, said Robert Cottrell, a law professor at George Washington University, is to leave black residents in high crime areas vulnerable.
One of the problems I think that we have in places like Chicago, New York, Washington, D.C., is we make it very difficult, in some cases almost impossible, for the individual who is law-abiding, who is peaceable, to defend himself.
That's exactly why gun owner April Howard and her husband Ken don't live within Washington's city limits. Ken Howard says that was a very deliberate decision.
D.C. is strictly very prohibitive legally. It seems as though the only ones who are able to have weapons like this are the criminal element.
Those arguments don't sway Jeffrey Brown.
We have way too many guns in our community at this point.
Brown is associate pastor at Roxbury's 12th Baptist Church in Boston and has spent years in faith-based coalitions trying to reduce gun violence in the city's black neighborhoods. Reverend Brown says many people think the country's gun problem has a racial component, but he believes race is only part of the puzzle. Economic disparity, residential segregation, chronic un- and underemployment. He says all those create depression, anger, and hopelessness in many black communities that allows gun violence to flourish.
When you see all of these factors coming together, the gun piece makes it more horrifying. And so it's a little more complex than just guns and race, but the problem is there for us.
And the solutions remain elusive. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, January 16th, 2016. So I have been told a compensatory call-in. Folks would like to participate. The number to dial is 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-P. pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. That number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. We will be here tomorrow. It is our early broadcast. That is Sunday, early. Our global Sunday talk on racism. Already confirmed, we should have participation from South Africa, Norway, London. I suspect we might even have some of our Canadian folks chiming in. But global Sunday talk, it's 12 noon Eastern, 11 a.m. Central, 9 a.m. Pacific Sunday morning. So if you're, you know, not going to be involved in any sort of religious ceremonies or camped out for playoff football, you can tune in. It's only roughly between 60 minutes and 90 minutes. We don't do the full hangout for 3 hour thing, but short, concise conversation. And we'll be hearing from folks, Cal's listeners who are outside the states. Some of them had already expressed that they wanted an opportunity to give their thoughts on air about the passing of Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. So we'll make time to do that, and then other observations on the system of white supremacy. But that is tomorrow morning, a little bit more than 12 hours away. Tune in. We should have consecutive white women on the program as well, Monday and Wednesday of the coming week. I'll give details on that down the road, but always enjoy having white people on the program. That was reminded, even shared that with a listener this week. Like, this program, it was intended, designed to have white people as guests, and predominantly white guests. I always wince a little bit when people make guest suggestions and they'll have like a whole list of non-white people. It's not that there aren't non-white people who have constructive information. We've had many of them on the program down through the years, but you know, really, I think we would all benefit from being able to get better, improving our skills, asking questions, and using words to reveal truth and to neutralize racists directly, getting the opportunity to talk to them. So always enjoy and look forward to having whites on the program. Should have several coming up Monday, Wednesday. Moving forward, we are fundraising for 2016 Invest. If you think the program is constructive, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. Listener supported counter racist radio. When you hit the blog, you will see the PayPal button in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, drop us an email and we will get you a physical mailing address. With that, a couple quick things I will point out before we get started. I did not include a clip about the armed thugs in Oregon, right down the road from myself. I did not include a clip, just trying to balance things out to make sure we had time for people to share. But that is certainly something folks should be keeping an eye on. That is the offspring of the infamous Cliven Bundy. About 2 years ago, I guess he got a lot of attention. That is still going on. And at least from the reports that I saw, they were damaging federal property. They took down a fence. And even I saw one of the reports that was saying that they were on some of the federal computers and looking up government employees and their information, and even stalking some of these folks sitting outside their residence and watching their comings and goings. And I have still seen no escalation of violence. Again, I could only imagine how this would be handled if black people decided to do this sort of thing, or non-white people, period, decided to do this sort of thing, if white enforcement officials would be so gentle and lax in their response, or lack thereof. I also saw this week, it was an editorial on CNN that you can read, where Trayvon Martin's mother, Sabrina Fulton, where she explained why she is endorsing suspected race soldier, Hillary Clinton. It is election season, so you'll probably see a lot of this. I would say that this might even be just another illustration of racial showcasing. And I particularly think there's going to be a lot of that with Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, both suspected racists, where they're going out and trying to appeal to black people and we're cool, we hear you. I was at the Black Lives Matter protest. See, I took, this is my selfie with some of the protesters or doing some events. We got the MLK holiday coming up on Monday for them to go out and do some events for that. I paraded or I marched or something of that nature. I expect it's going to be a lot of this all the way up through November. And just, you know, to be alert about that and even have your responses ready if this is something that comes up in dialogue. In her op-ed, she goes a lot into gun control and saying that she thinks Hillary Clinton will do what she thinks is correct in terms of trying to reduce, minimize gun violence, particularly gun violence as it affects black people. You can, you know, check it out at CNN if you're so interested. I would just make sure if you were going to comment or critique when this sort of thing comes up, when they're doing this pandering to get black voters, to get non-white voters to direct any criticisms to the white people. That's my view, where it doesn't come something, I can't believe she's endorsing Hillary Clinton, no good, that sort of thing. Sabrina Fulton certainly, I would think, would have to qualify as a victim of white supremacy. That being said, I would have no beef with her, whoever she votes for, if she, you know, decides to vote at all. My beef would be with Hillary Clinton. This is standard operating procedure in dangling out white people that are supposed to be friends, allies of the Negroes. And we should go out and, you know, vote for them, or at least verbalize that we're going to vote for them. We're down for them. Just standard operating procedure about how the plantation runs. Other quick things that I wanted to make note of. I thought it was very important. Mr. Fullerton, we'll probably spend some time on this tomorrow, but just Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, I think she had commented quite a bit, and other people had mentioned this as well. I'm just highlighting again with regards to the stroke that she had, and Mr. Fuller said that apparently Dr. Welsing's doctors had told her that the stress of dealing with the noise coming from the daycare, Jewish daycare that was close to her residence, that could indeed cause health problems, and a stroke was listed as one of the possibilities. Just the stress in dealing with it and wrangling and trying to get them to do right and feeling as though you're being pressured to move. If that is the case, if that is indeed what happened, this would just be another tragic filing in a seemingly endless list of evidence to demonstrate white people's increasing efficiency at confiscating, stealing black property, something that we've been talking about for a long time. But if folks who think that that is logical, that they think that's what could have happened here, and it seems like it could be, and then seeing how what happens with the property, her residence in Washington, D.C., that would definitely be, I think, a very personal and painful reminder about the power that white people exert in terms of taking property. And I think I said before that they have a myriad of ways. They don't have to do it Black Wall Street style anymore to come and drop a bomb on you and that sort of thing and shoot up the whole neighborhood. They have many, many more ways where they can be much more insidious about it and just sit back and bide their time and accomplish the same objective. Next up, I don't know if anybody saw the documentary, The Hunting Ground. I'm going to try and check it out after the film, but I think that is something that we should have watched. It came out last year, and it got more attention towards the end of the year. I think Jameis Winston, Tampa Bay Buccaneers quarterback, is one of the featured subjects. It's all about rape on college campuses. Might even, with everything that's happened with the attacks, the alleged rapes that took place in Germany, Cologne, Germany, right at the beginning of 2016, and then Finland, I think they had put up a big sign, one of these European countries, and it was basically saying that these, you know, dark people are coming here and just raping white women. I thought it was looking very much like a whole environment where this is being coordinated. I think there was a big gang rape that was reported in New York City last week. I think it was in Brooklyn, specifically reminded me of the Central Park Five case, and even Governor LePage in Maine, his comments notwithstanding, but It reminded me of the Central Park Five case. There was a teacher in New York who just lost her job for teaching her students about the Central Park Five case, which I think featured Donald Trump pretty significantly in what happened with this, you know, false conviction of these non-white males, mostly black males, in this case back in the late 1980s, the Central Park wilding, where Donald Trump, he took out a full-page ad in the New York Times. Long history. You talked about this a lot, but just seemed like a lot kind of pushing in that same vein of, oh my gosh, these dastardly raping darkies, what are we going to do? But yeah, The Hunting Ground, if anybody has seen that, might be good to hear a word. I'm going to make time to watch that later on today. The last thing I will get in the segment, it was, I think, the very first clip, audio clip, news clip that we played this week. I was talking about former Alabama governor George Wallace, who ran for president, if memory serves, in 68. He was an assassination attempt. They did not kill him, but that kind of had an impact on his presidential run. Anywho, where they were talking about his daughter and her efforts for forgiveness. I thought it was so telling when they talked about Congressman John Lewis, who was almost beaten to death in Alabama as a result of Governor Wallace's white terrorist actions. But they, when they last year, when they were going to do their walk on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, which is named after a notorious white supremacy and they white supremacists, and they did this deliberately, white citizens in Alabama. Anywho, that he was making so much of an effort to make sure that she was comfortable, to make sure that she was okay. We're not going too fast for you. That is standard in terms of when white people come and they infiltrate and say that, hey, I got to hang out and rub elbows and maybe even do a little bedroom action with black people for forgiveness. And this is making progress and we're working against racism. That is standard, where the white person's values, needs, concerns end up taking precedence over the victims of white supremacy, which is just, in my opinion, that's just another replication of the system of white supremacy at work. But I just found that astounding. It reminded me of Dr. Welsing when she was talking after the Charleston shooting. We do not need any white people to come and hang out with us about anything. That is totally unnecessary. You're not working against racism. In my view, it's just adding to the confusion to make a lot of us think that there are some cool whites that are not racist. She's definitely no George Wallace. We've made so much progress. If we just had 8 or 10 more like her, we'd have this racism thing licked in, you know, a couple days. And just nothing could be further from the truth. Very sad. Moving forward, if folks have any comments on the audio clips, I'd asked this before, if people, you know, thought there were too many, or if we should do away with them and altogether, or have fewer of them, and maybe instead of doing 60 minutes approximately of news audio segments, maybe do 30 minutes or 40 minutes. Folks can give their vote. I think it's been a couple years since I asked. The last time I asked, I think it was pretty lopsided in people saying that they thought the clips were constructive and they didn't have a problem with them being about 60 minutes. I just have been doing it at 60 minutes because one of the things that I've observed is that a lot of victims of racism don't get to spend as much time checking the news and going through and kind of seeing important things that happened over the last 7 days or so. So this is one of the ways that I try to compensate for that. This is the compensatory call-in. That's one thing that we're compensating for. And I mean, certainly in the 60-minute audio, you don't get everything that happened in the news, but at least to try to cover some of the things that were significant, that were directly dealing with racism, sometimes things that are indirectly related to racism, white supremacy. But that's why it's done. If folks don't think it's constructive or if there should be less of that, you can feel free to voice your opinion on that, and we definitely are down to reconsider because I know it's been a while since I asked for input on that. With that, if you have commentary, feel free. If you could remember that there are other people on the line with your commentary, so just be mindful of how much time you're taking up. No metaphors for the Saturday program. That is a new rule. No metaphors. And the reason, again, is just to promote clarity. As I've said consistently, when I hear people talk about racism, white supremacy, the metaphors get really out of control a lot of times, and things are being compared that are not equivalents at all. It happens, I would say, all the time. You can just set your watch by that. So just to get people to be clear, about what it is that they're saying, to try to be as explicit as possible without relying on a lot of comparisons and things to get your point across. That would be grand. If you could watch the background noise and just speak one time, share whatever you want, and then allow other folks to get their one turn in, and then we should have ample time if you want to make a second comment or something else comes to mind that you want to make sure you get out to listeners. Thank you kindly. Everybody who dialed in with a hand up, your line should be open.
Greeting, have you heard?
I heard a couple people go with retired firefighter. That was the first clear voice I heard.
Greetings, everyone. First thing, I'll just read it as I saw it. Jada Smith is new face of Louis Vuitton women's wear. I think that's the only thing I'll say on that. Number two, it seems though the tradition of non-white black people having a hard time finding a cab ride in New York City goes on, with Mr. latest victim being Mr. Al Roker and his son. Number three, elements of the New York Police Department are allowed to function as terrorists. Regarding the non-white black people who were part of the Eric Garner, the survivors, a part of the Eric Garner case. And more than likely, there's other situations that goes on that we don't know about, but that's basically what I got out of the latest report on the survivors and close friend of Mr. Garner and what they're going through by New York police race soldiers. Hold on, light just went off, went out. The media, I was kind of glad to see that the media cannot use Richard Sherman to criticize another victim of racial white supremacy, Cam Newton. Sherman explains, if you can celebrate on your job when you do something successful, Cam Newton should be able to do the same and not be judged by others. Both of these non-white victims of racial white supremacy are opponents. Will be opponents, I think, in it very soon in a NFL playoff game. But I think Mr. Sherman was articulate enough to only focus on the contradictions that people have by trying to, you know, it's the old tactic of trying to pit black people against each other, and I thought he recognized that and responded constructively. Speaking of professional sports or sports in general, I recognize, and a friend of mine also all the time recognize the large amount of quote unquote, in my opinion, unattractive white women who dominate the NFL sidelines as media and commonly white females who are panned in the stands to imply female beauty during college games. Now, back during the 70s and 60s, I've seen some of these films, they've actually would comment on it. But I think nowadays they may have got some kind of directive not to really comment on it, but you really don't have to. If you follow film or look at enough things on film, the film itself have an expression that can be quite clear to a lot of people on what that camera is trying to portray. And I just wanted to give some kind of observation to that. The whole scenario of the NFL is basically a modern day Roman Empire form of entertainment, primarily with the black males are primarily the gladiators for everybody's entertainment, and they are basically are considered, and they even say it in a lot of cases, as beasts and animals. Those two names are sometimes directly associated with black male athletes. Last but not least, I have here white supremacists are encouraging and financing anti-sexuality to confuse and deceive victims from solving the problem of racism. That's what I see in a lot of these so-called efforts that are nationally televised or filmed in news on implying that we are attempting to deal with the problem of racism, white supremacy. But primarily, what I'm noticing internally about these some of these organizations or even some of these individuals that they are giving attention and support financially, even by powerful white people who are practicing racism. I do notice that a lot. And thank you, and that's all I have.
Right on. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, do y'all have comments?
Yeah. Have you heard?
Thomas in New York, we'll go there.
Good evening to all. Good evening, Gus. Had a few observations this week, but first I'd like to make some comments on the clips you played. You started it off. White people are not crazy. They're not deranged, sick, mentally ill. They are racist. They do not deserve redemption. Their crimes have been irredeemable. We can never forgive them for committing the crimes that they've done against us because they've been premeditated. The NYPD seal on their uniforms also has an Indian and a white man. The white man has a whip in his hand. Very interesting when you look at it. I observed it one day. I was staring at it on the train, and I was like, wow. Wow. And we wonder why the guy who did two years in Rikers killed himself, did 2 years for a book bag, I believe, or hopped in the train style, something real petty.
Call
I think
Browder.
It was a book bag. Yes, Browder, yes, sir. You wonder why he killed himself. I mean, they're being fed rat poison inside of the prison. What was done behind that? That's just crazy. Say whites get economic advantages. I don't think that's being accurate. Whites are black economic terrorists. That's why they get the advantages they get due to their racist actions. My observations for this week, I entitled this one, F Those Other Niggers, and it's for a reason. It's about anti-blackness. But before I go there, I like to say I typed into the Google what was the most racist states, and two top 10 lists popped up, one from a white website and another from Atlanta Black Star. And appallingly, neither one of them had South Carolina on it. So after the show this week with the Confused Sister from Canada, those cowbells, I watched the NCAA championship football game. Two of the most racist state universities were represented. And they played a pretty good bowl game. One is the University of Alabama, George Wallace. The other, University of South Carolina, Ben Tillman. 90% of the players on the field, including the biggest star on each team, are black. Everyone keep that in mind. Alabama won the game. After the game ended, Alabama Ben's playing rapper C. Murder, his hit song. C. Murder is incarcerated. He's the incarcerated brother of millionaire rap mogul Master P. You know, a black man calling himself Master, very confused. The prosecutor played his songs at his murder trial and used them as a character witness against him. According to the jury, they wouldn't have found him guilty if they didn't hear the lyrics in his songs where he's rapping about shooting and killing people, of course, black people. Well, the game's over, and the players from SC are upset, of course. They just lost the national championship. They're crying. The players from Alabama are running around jumping for joy with the media running behind them, trying to get interviews. and the Alabama band is playing C. Murder's hit song, F Those Other Niggas. Of course, F has a, you know, I'm saying it for short. I just thought that was amazing. Tale of Two Cities, that's what they said in the clips. I say it's the Tale of One City. Another snuff film this week from the Rahm Emanuel Archives. First, we had Laquan McDaniel. His erased video footage from Burger King. Ronald Johnson was shoot running, or should I say sprinting, from the police. They said he had a gun in his hand. You couldn't really make it out even with the imposed video, but they didn't charge the police. And now we have this young brother, Cedric Chapman, gunned down similar to Walter Scott, just shot in the back. His friends were more than 10 blocks away. They were charged with his murder. I mean, that's just unbelievable. Of course, they copped out to lesser charges than murder. They're serving time in prison. And I had to wonder, why is Rahm Emanuel, who just had a huge banquet this week in Chicago with all the black politicians and reverends at an MLK breakfast, is keeping his own personal public, his own personal collection of these public executions. Boy, I wonder if he's doing it for his own enjoyment or if he's trying to, you know, sell these to a future television show, maybe Cops Going Wild or Cops Killed on TV or something. But it's just, he should be arrested, the prosecutor. I mean, this is obstruction of justice, conspiracy of murder. They're not getting due process. And, of course, white supremacy, which is a crime. Two references this week to the terrorist acts at Mother Emanuel Africa Methodist Episcopal Church. One, after the East Indian governor of South Carolina was showcased to rebuke the eloquently delivered state of the white supremacy speech that Obama gave. As she bragged about how SC handled the church shootings and how they also were very diligent in handling Walter Scott's case, and they didn't have any riots, unlike Ferguson and Baltimore, and how they took swift action against the cop. I mean, she was like the queen of it all, you know. And then second was in the Republican debate this week. You know, those Republicans are sure entertaining. You know, they're less refined Democrats. Question related to gun control was asked to Jeb Bush specifically about Dillon's ability to acquire illegal firearms. And I could tell this was all staged because he couldn't remember the name of the church, so he had to look down at his notes. Then swiftly he popped up and said the name of the church. So, I mean, obviously he had a talking point on it. And he wanted to paint Dillon Roof as insane, like he was mentally insane, an ill person. However, however, in my opinion, he was completely competent. He planned his actions. He knew who he wanted to kill. He went there. He asked for the person by name. He shot the witnesses. I mean, I think that was shows that it was deliberate and it wasn't nothing to do with insanity. And that was the only person who answered that question. And I have a story that relates to white supremacy that I'll share later if it's more time. But it was a direct incident that happened with me and white supremacy. And I got right into the question lane. It was a pretty good one. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Other folks who have a hand up, do you have comments you want to share?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Greetings to everyone on the line. First thing first, guess that clip that you played with the gentleman describing the dynamic expression of the mental derangement of white people. Who said that?
I forgot his name. He's a black male in Alabama. That's from Spike Lee's documentary, Four Little Girls. It's kind of the first 30, within the first 30 minutes or so. But that's their lead up to introducing who George Wallace was and his role and how that contributed to the church being bombed in 1963. But it was a black male, and he went through some of the, he's older. He looked like he was, that film came out like the late 90s, so he looks like he's probably in his 60s at that time, talking about his memories of Alabama in the 1960s.
Okay, thank you. The clip about the changing demographics playing out in the political realm, the population clip, I thought that the woman, Miss Alcroft, I think was her name, she revealed some truth when he asked her, do you think that the rhetoric that Donald Trump is following is going to get worse? She revealed a little bit of truth by saying, of course, like, yeah, it is. As the supposed threat to their genetic survival increases, of course, their response will increase in racism as well. Sorry, I have my things kind of written out, so I'm scrolling. The Democracy Now! Clip, Amy Goodman, I thought that she was practicing racism and white supremacy and kind of chiding Mr. Orta by asking him if he was sorry. Just that word sorry is ridiculous for her to use. She could have used anything, regret, which is how he responded to it. The word sorry makes it seem as though he needs to be apologetic for it to someone, which, of course, who would he be apologetic to other than white people? The clip with the New York, the Whiteboro town still, the part where the, I'm assuming she was a white woman, but of course I don't know for sure, but where she said, it's been here for a long time and I think it should stay, I thought that was a perfect summarization of how the so-called average white person views the system of racism and white supremacy, whether they want to admit it or not. It's been here for a long time. If it ain't broke, it's been here for a long time, it's going to stay in their mind. So I thought that was really revealing as well. The clip on Ethan Couch, and I didn't really fully catch that, but I did catch the part where she was saying that Tamara Rice's death was preordained. I thought that was kind of tacky to say that it was that child's destiny to be shot by that police officer. I do think that everything happens for a reason, but I also think that we have free will, and that police officer could have easily not killed that child. And to also compare that to these suspected racist who has been diagnosed as being too rich is absurd. The clip on Netflix, I'm not too sure exactly how I feel about that. I guess I'm confused about why that was included. Can you provide a little insight on why you included that?
I thought it was, I saw it yesterday. I think it got posted like Friday, maybe towards the end, Thursday, Friday, towards the end of the week. But I thought it was interesting because with entertainment and with this week, people, again, we're talking about the Oscars and black people not being recognized and long running conversations people have been having about representation of black people in film. And even some of the conversations about saying that the reason that there aren't more black leads is because there's no market, and particularly overseas, nobody wants to see all that. To hear this clip where they say, hey, this is the future. This is the new market, Africa. This is where we're going to go and make even more money. And then we're going to invest to get them to get Netflix so they can watch all this racist garbage that's going to be there, and then even original content that they create that's specific for the continent. But at the same time, they even have to realize that, wow, we have so thoroughly raped and pillaged this area of the world that you got a lot of people who they live on like $7 a month. Like, are they even going to be able to afford it? Like, I thought it was fascinating, like, with everything in context, to hear some of the points that they brought within there, and then to kind of have a global lens on what entertainment looks like globally within white supremacy.
Okay, thank you. That cleared it up a lot. And then lastly, your statement about Dr. Welsing and the stress of her living situation being a huge factor in her, what I call, untimely death. I can definitely attest to that. Stress is something that I don't think we have a full understanding of, how it affects our bodies, our minds, in particular non-white people. I think we tend to underestimate just how badly stress can affect us. And I know myself, I had a living situation wherein I ended up in the hospital due to the stress of it, of them not taking care of my apartment if I needed to. So I definitely agree with you in that that played a large part in her untimely death. And I will meet my line. Thank you for the show, as always.
Sure. Other folks that we have yet to hear from, if you all had commentary, feel free.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, guests and service to callers. I found it significant that in her last lecture, Dr. Frisicus listening, she talked about Donald Trump. She said that he basically pulled the sheets off of the system of white supremacy, which is very significant to me because all of the under, she also said all of the other candidates are keeping quiet about the system, but Donald Trump is, he's full-blown about it. He's explaining and talking about it so much. And she also classified him as pulling the race card, which I also found significant. And another audio where the global population, I found that also significant because they're going to claim that in 2042, the white population is going to be a minority considered. Because now the Asians and the Latinos, they top the global population growth at 43%, and then Native Americans, and then below that are the blacks, which the African Americans, they come at 12% growth, and lastly, the whites, who grow at just 1%, which represents the global minority. And that's all I wanted to share for now. Thank you.
Appreciate that. Good to hear from Bay Area listener. Glad you could tune in. Great observations on Dr. Welsing's last Welsing Institute lecture as well. Other folks that we have not heard from yet, if you had commentary you wanted to get in, feel free.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. I hope there's no feedback. My job had a Martin Luther King program in honor of the holiday on Monday, this upcoming Monday, and the topic was what diversity means to me, and the speakers were principals of of my particular organization, various principals. And most of these were Asians and Indians, Asian Indians and whites. And I just noticed the trend whenever, Martin Luther King Day comes around, I noticed the trend is to focus on diversity. And there's never a focus at all on the struggles or the history of blacks. It's always, this all-inclusive topic. So I just wanted to share that.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, good evening, guests, callers, and listeners. There's a lot going on. I just wanted to start by saying that at Dr. Welsing's transitioning with all of the posts that were on Facebook, one of my friends had a friend from Chicago, and he gave a testimony about how growing up his mother used to take him to Dr. Welsing's lectures, and so he grew up at her feet. And in my visits to the Welsing Institute, there are always children there. I think during the last lecture that she had, we heard a young man speak about how a child asked him, said something about, pointed to a doll and said that that was white supremacy. And Dr. Welsing said that you should give her a reward for that. And Dr. Welsing went into her anecdote about how she thought the Quaker, the guy in the Quaker Oaks box was God.
I'm just saying that because, you know, sometimes that, you know, we always talk about carrying on legacies and we always look to ourselves for that, and rightly so. But there were lots of children that heard Dr. Wells, and I was witness to at least two occasions where black people walked in with a whole row of children in that small auditorium, and they were listening. One of them was five. I remember when her and I had a really interesting exchange. She was very, very, very intelligent. So we should always hold that in our minds that it's not always on us. Our children, there were children that heard her, just as there are children who hear a lot of our speakers and elders. I just wanted to share how my past two visits at the store known as Costco has turned into some sort of turned into a terroristic situation for me, and I'm just wondering whether or not I got to continue shopping there. I'm in New York, so this Costco is in Yonkers. If anybody doesn't know the area, Yonkers is like above the Bronx, going into Westchester County, going into areas of that side of New York that are affluent, such as, I'm trying to think of some areas, Pelham and Pelham Manor and all of those places. Those places can be noted as pretty affluent. So over the years, that particular Costco has had more of an influx of black people going. It wasn't like that. I've been going there for a long time, but I've noticed that, like, over the years, more black people are getting hip to that Costco and a couple of other stores that are up there. So, you know, there's white people who shop there, and there are white people who work there. So I was online, you know, trying to save some money, buy in bulk for my little family. And a racist cashier, white racist female cashier, looks at me and says hello, and I greeted her. And she looked at my belt, and I had a big thing of coconut oil, organic coconut oil. So she says, oh, I hear that stuff is bad for you. You're not supposed to eat that. So I'm looking at her like, you know, ain't nobody ask her what she hear. She's here to bring my stuff up. So, I'm a victim. And I don't owe nobody an explanation. But, you know, sometimes you just got to respond. And I should have responded with a question. But I said to her, I don't eat it. I use it for cosmetic purposes. So she says to me, oh, I guess my daughter can put it in her kid's hair because he's half black. Looking at her, and she said, you know, and he's got this strange hair. So I'm looking at her, you know, me and my locks, and I'm looking at her, and he's got this strange hair, and, you know, I guess that's just, you know, it's not a good thing, but I guess it's not a bad thing. Yeah. So I look at her, and I said, you know, I said, I really don't know what to say, except that I don't eat the oil. And she's all into what she's saying. And she says to me, oh, did I give you your receipt? So I didn't say anything. I just walked away. So while I'm walking away, and all I could think about is this poor kid who's got to walk, you know, who's got to grow up confused like that Lacey Schwartz or something like that, that documentary that we saw where her mother lied to her all these years about her having a black father. You know, I'm thinking about this kid being raised by this racist grandmother. So when you go to leave that particular Costco, you have to stop and get your receipt, like, marked or something like that. So I didn't have a receipt in my hand. And a woman did say to me, the racist did say to me, well, you know, did I give you your receipt? But I didn't respond. You know, I was, like, all rattled. So I get up to the man, and he goes, where's your receipt? So I said to myself, you know what? I don't have one. And I say to the manager. So he goes and gets the manager. And I said, you know what? That cashier did not give me a receipt. And the reason why she did not give me a receipt, because she was busy letting me know that her grandchild, who is half black, has bad hair. And he's like, what? And I told him about the exchange. I said, so, you know, and it was very inappropriate. I come in here to the shop. I come in here just to get what I need to go, get what I need to get and go, not to hear a cashier and all of her racist remarks. And he says, I will take, it was a black manager, it was a young black man. And he's, you know, he said to me, I will take care of this immediately for you. And he asked me who it was, and I told him who it was, right? And he said, oh, she's new. I said, it doesn't matter, she's new. She could be, she knew, she be new, she could be old. She's not properly trained. So he said, I will be right back. So he went, because again, he's got to go on the computer. I don't know if it's a big security issue with people lifting stuff. I don't know what it is. So he had to go on the computer, you know, and get it manually, take my card and generate a receipt. And it took a good while to come back. And I looked at him, and I went, and I followed him. And he went over there, and he said some things to her, and she kind of looked at him like kind of strange. So I said to him, oh, I said, okay. He said, he addressed her. And she said, he said to me, I'm sorry, I apologize. What happened? Okay. I go back like 3 weeks later. This has happened within the past 3 months. I go back 3 weeks later. All right, I'm online. She's not the cashier, but she's bagging. And there was a young black woman as the cashier. So I said, okay. So she's bagging, and there is a racist male, white male, in front of me. And he says to the black female cashier, he says, I have a black card. What's the difference between this black card and the regular cards? And immediately my mind went to this episode on the cows where they talked about black robes and black, and you know, the significance of black in white supremacy culture, the black robe, the color black, where robes are concerned and black cars and stuff. And I was wondering, I said, I wonder if we talked about black cards, the power that black cards hold over regular credit cards and regular loyalty cards and things of that nature. So the girl says to the female black cashier says to the racist, well, the black card, you get points and you get discounts when you spend so much money, so much money. And so that's between that and the regular cards, right? And he goes, oh, it's my father's card, and he's saying all of this, right? So he goes to get his stuff. So she takes my little white card. She takes my white card, and she says to him, you know, he hadn't left the belt yet to get his things, and she says to him, see, she has a white card. She doesn't get what you get. And I said, okay, is this a swirl moment happening between them right about now? So the white racist looks at me, and he says, oh, well, I hope you don't mind. So I looked at him, and I said, you know what? Everything that's black holds more power than things that are white. That's the law of nature because it's dominant. And he kind of looked at me, the black cashier, dropped her head, started singing some song about Jesus. The white woman who terrorized me a few weeks before, who was bagging, turned and said to the next customer and said, can I help you? Then I went to look for the white racist who I said this to. He was nowhere to be found. So I don't, you know, so I just kind of like had it with the whole thing. So yesterday, I go into Costco briefly. I mean, just to get a little something for my kid before he goes back to school from being home from his college break. I'm standing there minding my business, getting ready to walk out. This white woman just walks up to me, a customer out of nowhere, and says, you don't look happy. I was like, what? I said, excuse me? She said, you don't look happy. I said, tell me what I should look happy about. Do you know what I should look happy about? How do I look? Tell me how I look. And she just kind of backed away and didn't say anything. So, I mean, that's just kind of been my experience there. I don't know if there's something going on with the ancestors that don't want me in that space anymore, or if it's just that white people have amped up their little their terroristic ways in that particular store towards black people, which I think that's kind of what it is. But that's all I had. Thank you for listening. I had to get that out. I'll mute my line.
Adventures at Costco. Wow. I know 909 had said before that he doesn't, he stopped shopping at Walmart because he was having too many incidents like that. I know there's a relationship between the two franchises, but yeah, I would gotta have your racist code, counter racist code together when you go out to the grocery shopping stores, because you never know when whites are going to go into their antics. It can just happen at any time. Really, we really can't afford to be lax in codification anytime you're around white people. I think we even had some listeners before who called in and said that they were shopping and had their headphones on, and a white person like tried to hit them with the basket while they, you know, were shopping, and they just caught it out of the side of their eye and were able to move. But I mean, really, it's no time that you can be loafing as a non-white person, particularly a black person, under this system. Fascinating. Any other folks that we haven't heard from who had a hand up? Do you have commentary you wanted to share?
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Hello, everybody. Peace to all. I hope you're all having a good evening. It feels very good to catch a live show tonight. I've been so busy, I haven't been able to catch one, actually. I missed the New Year's Eve show, which I was looking very much forward to. But the clips which you provided tonight were astonishing, and particularly, the one that stood out the most for me had to be the Democracy Now! Interview, where we finally got to hear from the young man, or the man, who filmed the murder of Eric Garner. And the fact that he was a man of few words, but knew instinctively, without thinking about it, that he would redo those actions if put in the same predicament over again because they were right. That says something to me about the righteousness of black action once when we are codified. I know we have Martin Luther King's birthday coming up, but one of the great things that I've taken from studying him was how organized he was at the outset of his campaigns in Selma, and what the people went through to become stoic and dignified in their efforts to change the system. Now, I'm not saying we put those same principles together for changing the system, but to become codified enough and ingrained enough to see that the righteous actions we may not get paid luxuriously for them, but they are right, and ultimately, morally, we are right for doing them, is correct. So I hope people take that away from that. And on the transitioning of our wonderful ancestor, Dr. Welsing, I cannot express the gratitude I have and have towards the work she did. She really played a significant role in opening my eyes over the last couple of years. I'm so very, very blessed that I had the opportunity through your show to ask her a couple of questions a few months ago. That really will stand out as a great, great moment in my life. With that being said, I hope she is resting, because Lord knows she has been in the trenches for so long. So I hope she's resting and she's having a good time with the ancestors up there. But that's all I have tonight. I hope you all have a good weekend. Peace.
Anybody that we have not heard from, if you had commentary, feel free to share.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, okay. I just want to say I didn't get all of the clips. I kind of heard it in and out because I was sort of getting up. But regarding the Whitesboro logo with the Aboriginal man and the white man, what I noticed from one of the callers, I believe it was a white female, when they were asking them about, you know, what do they think about the removal of the logo or not. And when this white female, this racist woman, described the scene as two men having fun, I think this is just one of the bajillion examples that you can't have a white person who is never not racist, because I'm looking at this image now just to make sure I remembered it, because I saw this as it was throughout Facebook, and make sure I'm looking at this clearly. I don't see where this brown person being strangled is any fun unless, of course, they're fundamentally racist and they cannot possibly... Sorry. Yeah, they must find it fun subjugating non-white people. So they obviously are dedicated and enjoy it. I think that the very fact that someone could actually configure that as fun is a classic example. And then when there was the black woman in the clip regarding Rahm Emanuel, I hope I'm saying his name right, when she talks about, you know, voting for him and the promise of politicians and, you know, the importance of inclusion, I think that the notion of, well, the fact that we don't look at these politicians, the majority of these politicians who run this system are white, I think this kind of gets left out. And this word inclusion, I think when we're countering racism, white supremacy, I find that inclusion, I think, is just another white supremacist tactic to avoid naming and addressing the system of white supremacy, because inclusion can often mean a number of things, like, you know, including more, you know, white LGBT, white women, even though they usually just say LGBT and women, rather than just focusing on the overarching, what I think is the overarching issue, is racism, white supremacy. And that's all the commentary I have, and I will mute my line.
Right on. Do we miss anybody? We have about, I don't know, 15 minutes or so, maybe a little bit more, before we get to workplace racism. Did anybody that had a hand up who has not been able to share yet? Grand. I assume that we got everybody. If you are on the line listening and you think it's something you want to comment on that is not related to workplace racism, you should get your hand up right now to make sure that you have time to share. Just on the MLK holiday that is coming up, we should be on Monday evening and with a white person, no less, so we can broadcast and talk about it then. But just my view from the many events that I have seen, participated in over the years that I've been on the plantation, whites have really made that like one of the tackiest days imaginable. I can't even say that they pretend as though that they have some regard. Really, a lot of it is just to totally practice racism in the worst way, and to distort the history of the life, the efforts of Martin Luther King Jr. I think some of the listeners commented where they'll just make it about diversity and, you know, let's LGBT this and just throw any and everything in there to totally move away from this being a problem of white supremacy and what this black male was doing at work against racism, white supremacy. I've seen the same thing. It just has really become a really tacky day. I really make an effort to try to avoid as many of these events and festivities as possible, and just, you know, do some constructive work. But whites have really, they have just turned it into a total racist clown show, in my opinion, for the vast majority of events that I've seen. The person that dialed in, let's see, we'll get Lady first. Upstate New York, did you have a commentary you wanted to share?
Hello, everyone on the line.
If you could speak up, your volume is a little low.
I hope this is better. Hello, everyone on the line. I just wanted to make a comment. I like the clips before the in the beginning of the program, because I do not get a chance to watch TV, and I don't get a chance to look things up a lot online. So it does update me on some of the racist activity. So for me, the hour long is good. My other comment was definitely in regards to the, I guess it was, I'm not sure if it was a flag or something of that nature, with the Indian gentleman being, or the cartoon with the Indian person being choked by a white person. And it just was definitely interesting with the commentary about it was just two guys having fun. There's nothing wrong with it. That's just white people talking in code, you know, making sure that they have some type of symbol, something that represents their racism, their need to harm people of color. So they like to have those things, and I think for them it's perfectly normal. It's something, you know, that they need to see, maybe to feel good in the morning. I'm not really sure. Had a small incident of racism, well, today, going to actually a health supply store, being in New York with the vitamin D levels getting a little bit low because of the no sunlight and not being outside. So I decided to go to the medical supply store and maybe invest in a sun lamp. And a white gentleman told me, well, I don't know, it seems kind of strange. It seems like some kind of voodoo. And I was like, a voodoo? It's a lamp. So afterwards, he proceeded to tell me that his son has it, and it really does help his mood because his son is bipolar and his vitamin D levels are so low. So I just think he just wanted to, you know, throw out something kind of racist, some kind of way to make me feel bad or have him recognize that I'm black and he's white. Of course, I didn't buy anything from there, and I won't be, because of his racist remarks and unnecessary. But it's just, you know, every day they do these little things. Another incident today at the library, went looking for books again, and this is the second time that this race soldier has done this. It was a librarian. In the children's section, told me, I'm sorry, we don't have any books by Negro authors related to that subject matter. So just they like to throw those jabs. Maybe they are on high alert because Monday is Martin Luther King Day, so maybe they just felt like saying the word Negro. I'm not really sure. Or voodoo, or just insinuating something related to me being black. Saw an article. Not sure how authentic the article was, about a gentleman being sentenced to 6 months in jail, but having only served 10 for making anti-gay remarks. And in the article, it was termed that that was ethnic discrimination. So I don't know if anyone knows about saying anti-gay remarks as being an ethnic discrimination crime. I'm inquiring because I looked it up. And there's actually, I don't see any federal laws on it, and I didn't see in any, in New York State, it being something that's termed as a form of ethnic discrimination. So I'd like to know if any of the callers have heard it termed that way. And that's about it. I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that. The caller at 8562. Did you have a commentary you wanted to share?
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Oh, that's Puff. Sorry, sorry. My bad. Sorry.
Yeah, no. That's okay. I'm not Bruce Jenner kinfolk, but okay. That's okay. Greetings, everyone. This is Puff. Just wanted to make a comment, just wanted to throw out there, as far as, and just wanted to make a general comment to everybody that's thinking about becoming a parent, or is a parent at this point, I want to encourage everybody to start putting your child's educational needs, as far as putting it up there with top priority as far as food, clothing, and shelter. Just want to put that out there. Don't wait till your child gets in school and then want to then show them things. Do things before your child starts school, teaching them how to read, how to compute numbers, colors, shapes, everything, all of that gamut. Just want to put that out there. Don't wait till your child is 5 years old to start doing this type of stuff. And, you know, it's never too late. All I want to say is, you know, if your child get to be 10 or 12 years old and is calling words instead of reading, where they are reading, in other words, statistics and probability, and they can't sound words and everything, it's not too late. Just go ahead and work with your children through school. And that's the only comment I want to make. Go ahead, everybody.
Right on, Puff. My apologies. And just to second that, I think Dr. Welsing would definitely champion that, and she did champion that for years on this program many times. And I would say if you really are flexing your black self-respect, you and your partner, you all will have extensive dialogue about your child's education before you even get to the bedroom. Like, this, these types of things should be talked about, discussed in detail, like way before the child gets here. Like, what are the first 10 years of our child's academic program? What is that going to look like? Like, have we already looked at schools in this area? Do they have independent options in this area? Is homeschooling going to be an option? What does that look like in our particular state or county or parish or wherever you happen to be at? Like, that's all of that should be thought about and discussed in detail, like before you get to the bedroom, so that you already have a solid idea of what you all are going to be doing for your child's education, because you know racists have already got it, that your child is going to be poorly educated, easily victimized.
And I also want to add a comment, just what you said, exactly what you said. I mean, it totally makes sense. You and Dr. Welsing saying this. I also wanted to throw out there the whites have a plan, and I'm going to tell you what the plan is. Why do you think, like, what do you think all that is preparing them for? The lines of tape in the hallways and no pictures and bleak colors on the wall? What do you think all that is conditioning them for? That's conditioning them for the prison system. That's the plan they have for your children when they become a discipline problem. And all of this type of stuff. And they will become a discipline problem when you just depending on the school to do their education with no plan and no discussion. Do you have homework today? No. And then just keep on doing what you're doing and then waiting until 9 weeks are up and waiting until the grades come home. That is not an educational plan. So what I'm saying is to everybody that has children, I don't care if it's their last year of school, get involved and have an educational plan for your children. That's all I want to say. Go ahead, Amanda.
Right on. We have about 7 minutes. If it's anybody that we missed, if you have a hand up and you just haven't commented, you should speak now. If you already spoke and you have something else that you want to make sure you get in before we get to workplace racism, you should do so now.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I had a short story to share, but from what the people said, man, Africans love their movies. They got whole stores in Harlem where all they sell is their low-budget movies. And I used to bring my daughter to an African lady to braid her hair, and it was like a shop. And, man, all they would do was sit there and watch those movies and laugh, and I'm like, okay, that wasn't funny, you know, but, I mean, they love their own movies, and they also notoriously for bootlegging white people's Hollywood movies, and they have an in-depth knowledge of them, too, so they're going to do very well in Africa with Netflix. Also, so what the lady just said, I don't see a difference between being called a Negro or colored or black or black American or African American. I look at them all as politically correct terms of the day for nigger that white people use. Depends on what day and time it was. I think my grandmother's birth certificate, she's a Negro. And I think my mother, she's colored, you know, so it's, well, it might be vice versa, but either way, my mom's on B. You know, so, I mean, it's just the politically correct term of the day they use to refer to black people without calling us a nigger. I was at the store, and I was trying to win $1 billion playing the Powerball. And the line was long, crazy long. I walked all the way up the hill to go to this store. And, you know, when I get to the store, to the front door, I see these two pit bulls. Now, they're chained to the little thing that comes down with the gate. They're chained to where the entrance of the store is, and they're like looking in at the door. So I'm like, oh, they must be looking for their owner. But I'm like, should I go in the store? Should I not? You know, because there are two pit bulls there. So I look at the pit bulls, and I see that they're like pets. They're not like really, they don't got that look. So, you know, I chance it. I go in because I was trying to get my tickets played so I could try to win $1 billion. You know, a brother could use that. So, first thing I observe is there's one white person in the store, and it's a dirty white boy with long, dirty dreads. He looked a little off, you know. His clothes were filthy, and those were his dogs. So while we were online, several times he gets out the way to push his dogs away so someone could enter the store, and he doesn't move his dogs though. So, you know, people are making little comments, and he's getting a little antsy. So when it's his time to go next, he wants to buy 150 tickets. He got a long list of numbers, and so that people got to, run all those tickets through. And he's going next. And this black girl, young girl, was leaving. And everyone in the store, there's another white guy now who came in. He's in the back of the line. So the black girl says, excuse me, sir, can you move your dog? Now, he's pissed because he's putting his numbers in, and he wants to stand there, and he tells her to wait. And she said, no, I'm in a rush. You got to move your dogs. I'm not waiting for you. You know, you should have your dogs here anyway. So he just turns around and says, shut up, bitch. So everyone in the store goes, you know, like at the same time. So I say, yo, who are you calling a bitch? Why would you call her a bitch? You got your dogs in front of the door. So he looks at me. Now, I'm a pretty big guy. I'm 6'5". I'm like 300 pounds. So he, oh, I'm sorry, sir. You know, I'm like, well, why would you call her a bitch? Apologize to her. That's not right. Would you call a white woman a bitch? So he said, I'm so sorry, ma'am. You know, I'm sorry. I'm trying to play my numbers and this, that, and other. She's like, I don't even care. She got her phone. She's calling her boyfriend to come to the store, ask him up, whatever. So he moves his doors out the way for her to leave. You know, she says some stuff to him. He got to take it now because everybody's against him. He goes back to the front of the line, and the lady says, you know, I cancel your order. You got to just move your dogs, and you got to get back at the back of the line. You holding up the line. You should have your dogs in the front. I didn't see those there anyway. So he's pissed. He goes to this loud scream. Ah. So I asked him, I said, would you do this in a white neighborhood? So he goes, oh, this is nothing about race, you know, and he gets into that. And, you know, this is crazy. So either way, by the time he – by the time he gets, you know, to the back of the line, you know, he goes outside, he moves his dogs. Everyone in there is talking about it. And you know what I'm saying? So he comes back in, and the girl shows up with her boyfriend and a few guys. And, you know, at this time, I'm playing my numbers, so I left. But they was outside waiting for him. But it was just like, you know, just the attitude of these people. Who would do this in a white neighborhood? Could you imagine? You know what I'm saying? That would never go down. And that kind of, you know, was my story. I blew my
mind. Wow. I will make sure to get in my commendation. Black self-respect. Great job sticking up for, you said it was a younger black female. Great job sticking up for her. And I concur. In fact, that reminded me of some of the other incidents that folks listed. The female caller that said she was in New York and went to Costco, and the woman, you know, both of the different incidents and the library incident, that, you know, this is just, this is whites. This is what it means to be white. I think when Jim Grimsley was on the program, the admitted racist, I think last Thursday, when he said that this is just us. We are looking for an opportunity to bully, belittle, terrorize, degrade black people, like always. Got to test them, see how much we can get over with. Yeah. That's just the way that they function. That's what I mean about you really got to be alert, because this sort of thing can happen at the drop of a dot. I shouldn't even say this thing can happen at any moment. You just cannot be thinking that, oh, everything is going to be fine. I'm not going to have any problems. These white people will behave themselves. You just can't think that way. It doesn't matter if it's a poor white person, rich white person, educated white person, ignorant, quote unquote, white person. We really need to be on alert at all times, because this is war against us. Also wanted to make sure I got in really quick before we got to workplace racism. That audio clip I thought was very important. We've had many conversations about legalization of cannabis over the years, where they reported in Colorado that a disproportionate number of those stores were located. I think the term that they used was minority, non-white areas. Did not surprise me at all. That had come up a few years ago, even in Seattle, because they did the same thing in Washington State, where they restricted where these stores can be. And they even had some areas where it was a lot of white people, like neighborhoods where it was predominantly white. They said, absolutely not. We're totally okay with you all legalizing, but we do not want those stores in our neighborhoods around our children at all. You cannot have any of the stores here. And they looked, and it was one of the black areas here in Seattle specifically, where there are very few spots where you can have legally have these stores. And it just so happened that, oh, yes, of course, we can have one smack dab in the middle of the colored side of town. I thought that that sort of thing would happen, which just further for me reinforces why I thought this is not going to work out the way it has been touted as some sort of counter-racist aim that's going to end up helping black people. I do not think that's the case, and I suspect, just continuing to watch how this is going to play out, because I know this is going to be on the ballot in California, the legalization issue, and I would bet the farm that it's going to pass. I think some of the other areas, I think Arizona and some other states are looking at doing that this year, because it's a presidential election, so I'm sure it'll come up. You'll have an opportunity to see in some other locales as this continues to spread how this all plays out. I do not think it's going to benefit black people, as I've stated for years now. With that, we will get to workplace racism. Forbes had a really interesting report. They were talking about women in the workplace. Now, I changed the title. I did post this. I put it on my Facebook page. I put it in the different Facebook groups and what have you over the week. I think quite a few people saw it over the past few days. I changed the title of the article when I posted it to reflect the fact that, in my view, it was pretty much exclusively focused on white women, even though it just used the term women as a universal, as though it was including all females, white and non-white. And I just don't think that that's the case. So this report, and it starts off by talking about how the workplace is a predominantly male environment, and females are not treated correctly, and they're not given the same rate of pay and that sort of thing. So they already have that dynamic. That's how they start the report. And then they get a little bit further down, and it reads, oh, looking at the wrong report. Wonder why this is not enough. So you get a little bit further down, and it reads, most people would argue that men tend to be more competitive than women. That's true, but men are more overtly competitive. Catherine Crowley and Kathy Eister, co-authors of Mean Girls at Work, How to Stay Professional When Things Get Personal, state women are complicated. While most of us want to be kind and nurturing, we struggle with our darker side. Feelings of jealousy, envy, and competition. While men tend to compete in an overt manner, jockeying for position and fight to be crowned winners, women often compete more covertly and behind the scenes. This covert competition and indirect aggression is at the heart of mean behavior among women at work. Might read the other paragraph, but I will stop. It was a fascinating article, in my opinion, and I believe these are two white authors who constructed this report. Again, it's at Forbes.com. Again, I think that they are talking about white women specifically. I think most of the people that go to Forbes are white, who read that particularly. It was written by two white women. I think that's who they were talking about. And I think that this accurately reflects the behavior that I have seen amongst white women, particularly on the job, and how they can be very insidious, very covert with their violent, terroristic behavior, which is why I think that they're so dangerous, because I think a lot of folks think of white males as dangerous, violent, aggressive, racist. That is a lot lower for white women, at least in my experience, and can be setting yourself up for a lot of trouble, especially at work. Workplace racism, if folks have comments that they want to share, feel free. The number again is 641-715-3640. And the code is 564-943-pound. Did folks have commentary on workplace racism? You are a little low. If you could speak up, sir.
Can you hear me now?
That is better.
Yes, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. I've noticed a couple of things on the job, but I'll just share about maybe two of them right now. The first was there was a young black male teenager that I have seen. I guess his mom works there. And he's just been learning different things in the various departments or whatever. And it's a very good thing to see, because he's very presentable, you know, very intelligent, educated young male. So I noticed that when I first met him, like, he was standing in the department and, you know, nobody was talking to him, nobody was conversing or socializing with him. And, you know, he was, when I observed him, he was reading a book. So I think I only spent 2 days with him. And, like, what I noticed, first of all, is when I was asking him about himself, apparently he is in high school still, and I think he's around 16. And he says he's on the debate team. And, you know, he says he says his favorite topic was talking about reparations and, you know, trying to say something about how paying reparations will stop institutional racism. And I'm like, whoa, you know, and, you know, I was having a conversation with him about that. And, you know, he seemed very focused, you know, on what he was doing. And I was just encouraging him, you know, and when he wants to go to college and whatever he wants to pursue after high school. And he said he wanted to be the president of the United States. So, you know, I was very supportive of him. And, but to end the story about this incident, well, not incident, but this observation, there was a judge, because I speak to the different judges. Most of them are primarily white. And when I didn't have the young male with me anymore, the judge, he was like, oh, well, you know, what happened to the young guy that was with you, you know? I was like, oh, well, he had to go back to school because the semester just started back. And he was like, oh, well, I didn't know whether or not, you know, he was just, he was here learning anything, or he was in community service. Yeah, he said community service. I was like, whoa. I was like, no, well, you know, his mom works downstairs, and she wants him to get some knowledge, various jobs that are done in the clerk's office. So I found it interesting he used the term community service with him being a judge. So, you know, part of what he does is hand out punishment to people for the things they do. And one last thing I wanted to speak on was, like, I know how Dr. Wilson, she would focus on like the symbolisms and how different objects and items symbolize like Black genetic dominance. Like, she may not have said those exact words, but I just had an observation or something. There was a, I'm trying to explain, I think it's like a cigarette thing or some kind of garbage can, and it's like right outside the back door where all the smokers, I guess, you know, dump the cigarettes. I think it's called a cigarette butts or whatever. It's a black trash can, and it's shaped like a phallus or whatever. And on the top of it, it says butts here, you know, and not like, and I walk past it every day, and, you know, I thought about it, you know, when Neely Fuller, he said, like, see what you're looking at. And I walked past this thing every day, and I was like, wow, and it says it in white letters. So black is like a black trash can. So, yeah, I thought about that, and that's all I had to share right now.
That is the way that whites think of us. The first incident that you shared about the comments that the white judge, I mean, even that's telling. He's so accustomed to going in and just passing out community service and convictions, I suspect, whatever other punitive actions against black people. Like, oh, 16-year-old, you must be some delinquent of some sort. I probably gave him a few hours of community service that he's here to knock out. Like, that is... That is fascinating. You can't just be here hanging out to learn and, you know, someone that we want to encourage to do great things. Like, no, someone like Ethan Couch. That's the way that we're seeing immediately. Yeah, definitely. And paying attention to things that are right around us. I think Dr. Wells and Mr. Fuller would definitely encourage that. Paying attention to things that are right in front of us, what they reveal about racism, white supremacy. Other folks, if you all had comments, questions, or your own anecdotes, things that you want to share, things that you've codified that are working out for you on the job, feel free to share.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Jeff, again, and to the rest of the callers. In my history class, we're learning about homage projects, and an homage is basically showing your honor or respect towards something old publicly shown. Usually it's an inspiration, towards like a person, place, thing, idea, etc. And we're also learning about our oldest arts, which connects to our homage projects and how to make them. So as we've been along through each oldest art, I've noticed how most of them connected back to Eastern Africa. And with those, we also saw the different forms of it and where it comes from each country, which made me think, wow, this would really show how it was important to me, because it really just showed how different things originated from Africa and they were stolen by different countries and used as their ideas, which is sort of another form of plagiarism. And that's what I observed. And also, there's this other art, and it's called a Venus figurine, and it's basically a sex symbol. There's some that are basically, they're skinny. They're just full out. They have long hair, long silky hair, and they're like full size. And there are some that are like in inches. They're very like obese looking. They have like big stomachs and shown uvula and stuff, and it's just tiny legs, big body, which was very significant to me, because to me it sort of looked like some of the actual black women in the United States, you know, the ones that are kind of obese, and that's what I thought. Those are my observations for the week at my school. Thank you for allowing me to answer.
Right on. Fascinating. I know that is absolutely something that has been talked about on this program, and many other people have written books and the whole nine about the centuries of theft that has taken place in terms of whites stealing parts of our either wardrobe and the way we do clothes or dancing, rituals, religious practices, anything that you can imagine, you know, the way that we cook and flavor, spice our food and what have you. It's a long-running legacy of theft of things that we have been doing for many, many centuries. So glad that you were able to pick up. That's probably going to be a long-running theme for as long as you're alive. You'll be observing that. Other folks have comments, questions, things they would like to share related to workplace racism? Everyone's doing great on the job. No problems. White people are doing right by you. Fascinating. I know I had thought this week there's so many people that dial in just to listen on the phone that eventually I should just randomly once per week nab one of the people that is just listening and ask for commentary on workplace racism, because I've talked to way too many folks and people have emailed me down through the years to share about different incidents that happen on the job, things that are said, things that, you know, they're having to deal with, where whites are trying to get them in trouble on the job, where I know that this is a massive problem, and then for, you know, whatever reason, people might be a little bit more reluctant to speak about things that they're seeing on the job, but it is supremely important to be analyzing and trying to figure out ways to minimize some of those problems, and I think just sharing, because as I've stated before, frequently, when you start to discuss these issues, you'll see that whites do a lot of the same things. Just that's a general rule in the system of white supremacy, but particularly on the job, they do a lot of the same things in terms of either policies that they have in place or how they go about trying to get a black person fired or messing it up so that you don't get adequate training, so that it'll be easier to get rid of you, or they can justify not giving you a promotion or whatever the case may be. It's very, very similar. You will see a lot of strong patterns on that end. So very important people be reflecting and paying attention to things that are happening in the workplace.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Workplace racism. Well, being that it's football season, I just wanted to mention in reference to workplace racism, the coaching industry on the.
Man, we can hear you. I'll nab you as soon as retired firefighter finishes.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm like, what the?
Sorry.
Right, that scared me a little bit. But anyway, how the coaching profession, white coaches are normally, when they get fired, they get recycled very quickly, and they get recycled back into head coaching positions, which is equivalent to what they had just, quote-unquote, lost. They receive other coaching jobs. And it doesn't matter on how great their record was in being successful. Primarily black males who are hired as head coaches, when they get fired, they don't get rehired as head coaches in other places. They go into some sort of obscurity as an assistant a coach somewhere, and you hardly ever hear of them again. You know, just something, you know, because, you know, you know, football season is quite popular, and I just thought I'd mention that, bring that up. Thank you.
Excellent point. Excellent point. And given poor opportunities, I know that as well. I think me being in Washington State, I remember Tyrone Willingham, who was the head football coach at the University of Washington and was universally hated by whites. They still hate on him. And he's been gone like, I think, 8 years at this point or so. But he had commented when he left that it is very difficult. This is for college football coaches, but he was just saying that a lot of times for black coaches, it's very difficult for them because they generally don't get like premier jobs. Like they don't get to go to an Alabama or a Clemson now that their program is good. To go there and see if they can be successful. They generally would be going to a program that is struggling so that they would be in what they call a rebuilding mode to try to see if they can right things and get the team winning again. And then if they fail, it's, oh, niggas can't coach. All right, we got to get rid of them and bring in some white savior to get things correct. But there's lots and lots of evidence and research that's been done on that. And that's worldwide. That's not even just with the states. That is a worldwide issue of black people experiencing workplace racism with regards to coaching and getting those types of positions. White welfare run amok all over in workplace racism. That's another great example when we talk about white people getting jobs and things that they're not qualified for. Professional sports is definitely great illustration of that.
Speaking of qualifications, one last little thing. A lot of us know that the University of Miami down here has hired a new head coach, and this is not unusual. What I'm about to say, he hired as the defensive coordinator, which is a very important position. If you don't know anything about football, it's like kind of like the second or third person in charge on a football team. And this is common of hiring a white person that didn't even play football in college at all. They didn't even play football in college. Primarily, this person was the son of the mayor of Miami at the time. And all of a sudden, he went from just going to college as a regular college student. His first job was as an assistant coach on the college level. You know, I mean, just there are literally thousands of black males. This is why I'm mentioning it for the most part. There are literally thousands of black males who have played college football and play professional football, has an extensive amount of expertise and knowledge of the sport, and in turn, what's most important to me, that they can positively impact black males, younger black males on all levels, high school, college, and the NFL, which is very much needed on the NFL level and college level. And they can't even get jobs. But a white male who didn't even play college football at all can get an important job like that at one of the top known college football programs in the world. Just, and it's not uncommon, unfortunately, that takes place primarily with white males. And that'd be all for me.
Oh, it's predictable, I would say. It's totally predictable. And again, as I said, all areas of people activity. I guess I would conclude just the caller, the male caller that brought up the symbolism of white supremacy. I think, yes, I mean, it is white welfare. And I mean, you get a lot of cushy jobs for a lot of these white coaches to make millions of dollars, or even if they're not getting big time, but just to get a job where they can be in a position of power and stay there for a long time when there are tons of black males who would be qualified for that. Symbolically, that is very important. So that, yes, you have, you know, tons of black athletes who are the dominant player on the team and do really well and score all these touchdowns and everything. But symbolically, to have all of that being managed by a white man, that just symbolically, the same way that was talked about those white cheerleaders on this, all of that is hugely important symbolically under the system of white supremacy. So it's a lot more than just, you know, we don't want to hire black people or whatever. It's a lot going on symbolically with that, too. But anyway, workplace racism. The female caller that chimed in, did you have commentary? I just heard her. She had hung up. Were you? We just heard you. Did you mute your line? Did you have workplace racism commentary you were going to share? Maybe she got...
Hello?
Oh, okay. Yes, we can hear you.
I'm sorry. That's not right. This is Princess.
In New Orleans, I believe I called a couple of weeks ago and was talking about the Beckys giving me a hard time on the job. And basically, what's going on now is since I had contacted corporate, it was a racial remark that was made by the assistant store manager. And so when I wound up contacting corporate, they were supposedly doing their investigation. In the meantime, they had moved me to another store to be at for the time being. I guess while they interviewed some of the workers and stuff to pretty much corroborate what I've been saying. And in the process of that, I had learned through another coworker. He had notified me that the store had recently gotten robbed. And so basically now, while the robbery was happening or in progress, this assistant store manager had ran into the office and pretty much locked herself in the office and refused to come out. She was calling everybody but corporate. And when she did finally come out and the police were trying to question her as to what was going on, she made a remark in saying that, you know, she was yelling throughout the building saying that she's tired of being here and y'all got me in the hood with these people and, you know, just went on some type of racial rant. And so she did this time in front of several people. So now, you know, nobody can dispute what was initially said when it was just her and myself when she first made her initial comment to me. But as of today, I had learned from the other coworker that they're trying to sweep things up on the rug. So he's requesting somebody from corporate to come down to speak to him. And possibly myself, because pretty much we're the only ones that are, like, fully aware of what's going on and that are willing to take it to that level. And I never let them know that I knew majority of the people, as far as the white people that have been involved, they're all friends. So when the district was initially divided and broken up, all of those top-level spots were given to their friends. Whereas the east of, I guess what they call the east side of New Orleans is pretty much what used to be the good side until Contrada. So I guess they refer to that as the hood. And but at the same time, the way the district was divided up, it's more or less in the east. You got all of the people that are buddy-buddy with all the other white managers and stuff throughout that system. And so I had my meeting with my district manager, and basically kind of what you were saying earlier, Gus, he was, you know, talking about the lack of training experience I had and some of the stuff. And I was trying to keep my composure, and the store manager that I'm with, who happens to be a black male, who happened to be the initial manager that I was trying to get up under after I left my first store when I had to go corporate on the psycho manager that I had there, white female. And so once him and I had sat down and he realized who I was, he sat in on the meeting. He didn't comment much. And we talked afterwards because he said I'd never witnessed nothing like that. And he was just commending me on how I kept my composure throughout, because he said he was basically, you know, way out of line, but I just, you know, I kept my cool. But so now basically he has spoken to our pharmacy department because he's trying to get me into pharmacy. So that way I'm completely separate from the front end of the store. And so that way, you know, I'll be able to remain there and not have to worry about dealing with his their network of cronies and stuff and throughout the region, because they're trying to block my transfer. And they've already did that, because when I was trying to call Florida, I had gotten in contact with some people who were willing to hire me pretty much on the spot and had me there within a week. But this assistant store manager, who I have been having issues with, she intercepted the calls at the office and gave me a bad review. And so when I reported that to the regional manager who had came down from corporate, they're now trying to say, oh, well, the call was passed on to your previous manager, who was the one that gave you your review. And I was like, that's a lie, because I never told you, you know, exactly when and what time I had called. And based off of what they're saying, they're trying to make it seem like it was a long conversation, when in fact it wasn't. I have the original call logs, what time I called, who I spoke to, everything. So I never mentioned that to them until this past Tuesday. And so now they're trying to backpedal and conjure up whatever they're trying to conjure up to do whatever. But let's see.
Since we do have a pause, I just thought it would be a little intermission. That sounds...
I'm sorry.
Oh, no apology. I was going to say that sounds like it might be astonishing. Like, that might be two examples of black self-respect, if I heard correctly, that you got a commendation from another black person, a black male, on being composed when you were being confronted with, sounds like, some suspected race soldiers, some whites who were being way out of line, I think was the term that was used, but you were very composed in the way that you conducted yourself, using words, I assume, and being in control of your emotions. Did I hear that correctly?
Yes.
Awesome.
He was trying to commend, let him know that I knew that him and my former manager, their friends, buddy. So while he was talking about my former manager giving me my review, he was talking about how he doesn't mix politics and religion, but then it was like, kind of like how you say, you know, he also used the word fair, and I was, when he said it, in my mind, I was thinking, okay, he's about to use the word fair, so that means he's about to be deceptive, and sure enough, that's when he started lying about something, and I was just shaking my head. And the black manager, he was just looking at me like he knew I was. So he had said something along the line like, well, it's not like I'm going to give you, he was like, if anybody calls me for Florida, I'm going to allow you to own your own transfer and, you know, speak for yourself and market yourself, because it's not like, you know, you deserve a four or this and the other, or, you know, and I'm going to give you such a glowing review where you're going to be smiling from ear to ear. When he said that, I was just thinking about like a Cheshire Cat or something, like, I don't know. And I was just like, okay. And I was just nodding my head and just looking at him. And he tried to lie and say that in the meeting that I had with my manager, when her and I had got into it a few weeks ago, that I had called her out her name or something. And I looked at him, and he must have knew I wasn't playing with him at that point. I said, I don't know what you guys are up to, but I never was discourteous with her, disrespectful, this and another. I never called out her name. I was like, that's an absolute lie, and if that's where you guys are going, then we're going to have a serious problem. And he was like, well, it doesn't have to be a serious problem. I said, well, I'm just letting you know. I said, in fact, I'll go ahead and let you know exactly what I said to her, because
she had said, I can't really remember at this point because there's just so much stuff going on. But my response to her was, well, frankly, I'm just tired of your racism. I was just very direct and just, you know, I, at that point, didn't care. And because, you know, how white people are, when you point out their racism, they react. And basically she was like, I can't believe you just called me a racist and this. I'm like, no, that's not what I said, but if that's how you feel, you know, shoe fits, wear it. I said, but I'm telling you as a victim, you know, your behavior and your conduct throughout this office towards people is, I see you practicing racism. And then that's when everything just imploded from there. So he just looked at me and was just like, and I was like, well, you know, so I don't know what you guys are plotting over there, what you're saying. I said, but, you know, at the end of the day, it's about the racism. I don't care what else you guys talk about or say, but that's what my complaint was about. That's what I came out and said. I said, she labeled herself as the racist, not me.
That's real important in terms of terms. That's why, I mean, that is the functional reason for why I say suspected racist, because sometimes white people will make it a problem for you and like, oh, you called me a racist. You know, that's defamation of character. Or, you know, I mean, just they're racist. So, but you can't, you know, just go around willy-nilly calling white people racist. Very, very important distinction to make.
Right.
And
so, right. And that's why I let him know that I wasn't playing around with him, because I was like, I don't care what you guys say about me. And this, and I said, I'm talking about racism. And I was like, I was just being honest. I'm being honest. I read the employee manual, and you know, unfortunately, the catch 22 with this particular company. The minute you mention anything about discrimination or racism, you will more than likely get a transfer. But the problem is that because they're all buddy-buddy in this networking system, because they know my first manager who I had reported on, where she literally almost lost her job, and I found out through doing anything that I'm at now, because they were trying to get him to take her position. It's just, they go out of their way, like I said, it's Voltron.
Oh, yeah.
They go out of their way to protect their own. And so now what my coworker today was saying is that basically they're sweeping the whole incident with the store manager, the assistant store manager, during the robbery, abandoning the store basically, and leaving everybody else to, you know, fend for themselves. They're sweeping that up under the rug. They're not going to discipline her.
I want to hang on.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Hang on 1 second. Sweeping under the rug, that is a metaphor. But, just point it out. With just some of the things that you shared, again, the danger of white women, I point that out all the time, and I know tons of people that write in the whole nine, like, white women are a huge problem. The white women are writing about how, wow, these white chicks are a big problem. I mean, you should just be very observant. I think you should, you know, just be very cautious in the way that you deal with them. And particularly, as I said, you do not want to be caught calling a white person a racist. Fair, that's why I always point that out, the use of that term, very important. Mm-hmm. And I also thought it was great black self-respect for this black male to be looking to get you training and in a position where these white people, where he can hopefully have you in a position where the amount of harm that these likely race soldiers can inflict upon you. Like, I thought that was great as well. Like, it was, I thought, wow, that is astonishing. Two examples of black self-respect in one bit of sharing. I just wanted to check in because we're getting close to the end to see if there was anybody else, if they had a comment, workplace racism, like if you've codified something, figured out something that works well to minimize problems. I know we have some folks that are taking seriously getting opportunities for black people to produce resources where you can do this from home, where you can minimize contact with racists and victims of racism. Folks are definitely interested in that. Anybody have something they want to share to wrap things up?
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Oh, yeah. Am I pretty clear?
Yes, I think so. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah. Make it real quick. My name is Sam. I'm calling from the top. And, I work for a school district. I'm a campus resource officer for 16 years in Southern California, L.A. And recently, about a year ago, we were all laid off and we were brought back by a state administrator, white guy, like white racist suspect. And, you know, he made all the black officers and black female and Hispanics, made us all requalify for our jobs and, you know, get re-fingerprinted, get drug tested. You know, we never had that in 16 years. So that's what he came and did. So some of us got rehired, some of us didn't. I got rehired, you know. But at the same time, when he came in, he brought his niece in, who's head of HR now for us hiring and signing. And she came in with a straight attitude. She came from Beverly Hills Unified. Now she's working in Inglewood. And she making us do all these extra tests, extra physicals that we ain't never done, having us get firearm permits, and we don't even carry guns. So I guess a firearm permit was a way for us to see if we have a criminal record. Some of us had backgrounds where we couldn't get a firearm. You know, some of my friends, they got fired for that. So the governor, Jerry Brown, he fired that guy because he made some racist comments about the area that he worked in. And so now we got a black administrator there, black state administrator there now from Oakland. He's there. And, you know, I told people, I said, you know, this school, they brought a black guy there, but we can't be hoping this guy's going to make promises to anyone because he was sent there by another, you know, by a white person. So, and everybody getting all happy and all that stuff, but still, I mean, he's not in charge. You know, I try to tell people that on my job, hey, they might send a black face there, but he's not there to fulfill none of y'all hopes and dreams. He's just there to, I guess, keep things cool. There's a black face there. Don't mean things gonna change. So, you know, very heavy racism on the job, and I finally trying to get my benefits. They took our benefits too. Some of us got them back. I'm trying to get mine back. So, that's a tug of war in itself. So, and that's all I wanted to share. Thanks.
This was the niece. This was a white woman. You said from Beverly
Hills.
Yeah,
white lady. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, Beverly Hills Fox, she came down, he hired her.
Right.
To put her over HR. So now the black guy there who's a administrator now and they bumping heads.
Mm.
No, cause now we used to send them emails about how the rehiring was kinda strange, and he's like, hey, if you've been there 16 years, why you gotta go through this rehiring thing? You've already been here all these years and requalified. He said that didn't make sense to him, so now they're bumping heads.
We'll see who wins that. We'll see who wins that conflict. I will wager on the white woman. That is hugely important. I thought you were talking about President Obama for a second. Remembering who is in charge. Like white people can decide if, you know, that black guy can be out of a job like tomorrow, like in the next 10 minutes.
And then her job is getting happy. Hey, you know, maybe she leave. I said, I don't think she leave anywhere. I mean, I know it's just her. And there's a black administrator now who came from Jerry Brown, but she's more cocky and bold than ever. You know, she lives nowhere near Compton or Inglewood. She lives way in Torrance somewhere. And I don't see any fear in her, you know, no fear at all. I don't see it.
It's not about losing her job, about what this black guy can do to her. I'm sure it's none there because there's none warranted. She knows that she is way more powerful than he is or any of the black people. But I also was going to say it's important because you said that the white guy got fired because he made some racist comments. That's really, really important in terms of documenting, even in relation to what Princess shared previously about the white woman. She, I guess, when there was this alleged robbery and the white woman was making racist remarks publicly about, you know, you put me in the hood and with these people and that sort of thing, and several people heard this, it's important if there's a paper trail where it's, this is not an isolated event. Like, you cannot just say that this was a traumatic incident, you know, the robbery and everything, and so she was not thinking correctly and that just slipped out. It's, this is the second or third or fifth report of a comment that, you know, sounds like something a racist would say, that has been documented that she said. That's why I say the importance of documenting, even if you don't use it today, you know, next week, it could be important. A year, if you stay, depending on how long you stay with that particular company, it can be important down the road where it's, now there are 5, 10, 15 incidents of you doing things that were suspected of being racist. It makes your case a little bit stronger. It shows a pattern of behavior. It helps you. It helps you. We did our three. We will be back tomorrow, though. Global Sunday Talk on white supremacy. As I said, should have folks visiting South Africa, Norway, London. Hopefully we'll have some of our Canadian folks tuning in. I know, as I said, folks outside the States wanted time to share their thoughts on Dr. Welsing and the impact of her work on their understanding of white supremacy. So I know that'll be prominently featured tomorrow morning. And then other observations. It'd be good to hear their views on the rapes that took place in Germany and how that has kind of reverberated through 2016 thus far. But this is tomorrow morning. This is our early program, so it's 9 a.m. Pacific, 12 noon Eastern. So much earlier than our normal broadcast. But again, this will accommodate people listening in who are outside the States. But should be, I'm looking forward to it, 12 noon Eastern, 11 a.m. Central, 9 a.m. Pacific, about 12 hours from now. Good to hear from everybody. If you have a problem, if you can't access something in the archives, you're looking for Dr. Welsing or whatever, drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. Suggestions, if you have questions about previous broadcasts, that sort of thing, untiljustice@gmail.com. Thanks for the folks. Yes, ma'am.
I had a question. Did you get that file that I sent you, the thing?
Oh, yes. Yes, I did. Yes, I did. I just need to carve out a second to view the whole thing. But, yes, I was able to download the whole thing right on Dropbox. Okay. Right on. With that. Thanks for everyone who tuned in. Hope it was a constructive investment of your Saturday evening. Invest fundraising for 2016. The PayPal is on my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not into PayPal, you can drop me an email and we will get you a physical mailing address. Thanks to all the folks who have invested down through the years. 7 years next month, 7 years broadcasting. Hope it has helped some folks get a better understanding of racism, white supremacy, and just things we can do, thought, speech, actions, emotions, to change our behavior towards producing a solution to the problem. 12 hours, we'll be back. 12 hours. Again, sobriety would be best under conditions of war. I know a lot of folks have what they call a four-day weekend in this area of the world, and you don't have to go to work or school on Monday. And so that becomes an excuse. That's why I said that they just, racists, just use this to make a total mockery of Dr. King, in my view. But this would just be an excuse for more debauchery, to go out and drink and do all of that. Sobriety would be best under conditions of war. Definitely if you're going to be passenger, driver, even pedestrian, you do not want to be under the influence. You never know when you could bump into Dan Pantaleo, Darren Wilson, Daniel Holtzclaw. You want to be lucid, clear thinking so you can make the best possible decision to keep yourself safe and anyone you might be responsible for. Avoid whites who are intoxicated. Things can go bad quick. I would even, you know, discourage being around non-white people that are under the influence, because a lot of times we just don't make quality decisions. We already have enough problems. We don't need nonsense. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice as soon as possible. Context of White Supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.